Hey man, this is Kevin Smith, and you're listening to the Skip to the End podcast. I suggest you don't do what the title says and listen to the exact whole thing. Don't skip to the end. Should be called Don't Skip to the End, but that's not marketing. That's bad marketing.
Skip to the end.
Welcome to episode 51 of the Skip to the End podcast. As ever, I'm Ben.
I'm Gemma.
And I'm Mark.
And if you were paying attention then, you'll notice we've had a slight change in personnel. Adam is no longer with us. He's not dead. He's just not on the podcast anymore. We have amicably parted ways. Mark and I just wanted to say thank you to Adam for all of his contributions over the last 50 episodes and almost 2 years. And we wish him all the best in his future endeavours. But as a door closes, a window opens. So we want to welcome Gemma to the podcast. Hello.
Hello.
How are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm feeling good.
Good to hear. I think this should be like a prize. You know that every time you've been on the podcast before, you've got a stamp.
Yeah,
your kind of fifth stamp, which basically won you the right to become a full-time Skip to the End member.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, see, so how's that?
Tell you what, commitment pays off, doesn't it?
It does indeed.
It really does.
Are you nervous?
Does that answer your question?
Yes, utter lack of response tells me everything I need to know, I think.
But ready and let's do this.
Let's do this indeed. Mark, we had a bit of an intro from a celebrity superstar then, didn't we?
Good old Mr. Kevin Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this follows on from when I went to see him at the Prince Charles, or the Charles Prince, as Tommy Wiseau says, in London.
Always
the premiere for Yoga Hosers.
Yeah.
But while I was there, I also got an interview with him. And I know a lot of people are like, when do I get to hear it? I'll reveal now, you've probably seen a few tweets, that Mark and Me is a podcast that's coming out in the next couple of weeks, which is, it's not me leaving Skip to the End or doing a solo album. It's for the stuff we can't fit on Skip to the End. So stay tuned. I'll check out Mark and Me UK on Twitter. And the first episode should be out in a couple of weeks' time.
And so on that, you're going to have a review of Yoga Hosers and an interview with Smith himself?
That's exactly it. Wow. What a debut for an intro episode.
That's not bad, is it?
I don't know how I'm going to kind of follow through after that. But
you don't want to follow through. You've had problems with that before.
No.
Let's talk about this episode, because this is 51. This is a whole new phase, a whole new era, a whole new feel.
Mm-hmm.
A lot's changing.
Yeah, and we've got a lot going on. This episode, we're going to be reviewing Suicide Squad, the brand new film in the DC Extended Universe, and I am tremendously excited to talk about that. Gemma, what film are we re-watching?
We're re-watching the absolute Japanese classic that is Akira.
Indeed we are. That was Adam's parting gift to us, picking Akira as a re-watch, and I'm very, very happy
Great
to talk
gift.
About that.
Yeah.
The topic of discussion this week is top three documentaries, which I'm very intrigued to hear people's choices. I've got a feeling we're going to have a really wide selection of stuff here.
I'll be honest. I mean, it's actually reopened my love of watching documentaries. Yeah. I've lost count how many documentaries I've recently watched as well. So
fascinating. Mm. We'll get into that. We're also going to be playing a brand new game, a brand new quiz called Get Fact. So later on this episode, we're going to be getting fact, and we'll explain what that means, what that entails later on in the show. We've also got a brand new feature. Now, a lot of people are sad to see Skip Back in Time go, but we're replacing it with a new feature called Movie Masturbate. We're going to be masturbating over a selection of actors and actresses.
Say it the right way.
Yeah, sorry. Mass debating over. And we're going to explain the details of how that particular feature works when we get to it. We'll also be taking listener questions, giving away great prizes, all the usual shenanigans we get up to here on Skip to the End. Before we do so, though, what are we going to do here, Mark?
I think we should have a little toast to Gemma joining as a full-time member.
Yep.
Each of us grab a nice, cold, refreshing Strongbow cider dark fruits.
It's high in the air.
And welcome aboard.
Thank you, guys.
Oh, it tastes so good, doesn't it?
So refreshing on a warm day.
Wow, that sings my taste buds alive.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Let's get started. Our topic of conversation this episode is top three documentaries. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I found this really difficult in the sense that narrowing it down to three was a colossal undertaking. It's been the toughest one for me, I think. And the three I've ended up picking, if you were to ask me this, let's say on the next episode, I could probably pick a totally different three and still be equally happy with it.
Exactly the same in this way as well. I think it's opened my eyes to some brand new ones that perhaps I hadn't heard of before. But yeah, I'm probably, this is probably going to change in like 2 weeks time.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Ben. Literally, the point there is I've never struggled so much. I used to think some of the early topics were hard. This is the one where I felt awful not writing it down and leaving them back in the kind of, I'm sorry, I will pick you one day for something else. But this has been the hardest topic we've ever done.
Agreed. Gemma, kick us off.
Shall I?
Yeah.
All right then. So I'm going to go with a punk biopic. So my first choice is The Filth and the Fury.
Nice.
All about the rise and fall of the Sex Pistols. Ah, this is such a good topic. I love that, really. So, yeah, basically, it's directed by a chap called Julian Temple, and he's done some really great musical documentaries in the past. So he's done about Glastonbury, the festival, and he also did another one which didn't make my top three, which was The Future is Unwritten, which is the Joe Strummer story. So this, I think this was always going to be on my top three because the way how it's pieced together and the way how it's shot is completely different to what I've normally seen. So they do obviously the piecing together of the story and the clips and the news bulletins, yada, yada, yada. But the Sex Pistols or the surviving Sex Pistols members themselves are all shot in the dark. You just see the outline of their shadow. So it's almost like you're, as a viewer, without sounding too douchey, you're in that moment of what they were going through at the time of the documentary. They have this amazing dig at Malcolm McLaren. Basically, he's in, when he does his interview, there's an image of someone in a blow-up fetish suit. Because the guy was, I mean, no disrespect to him, I know he's dead, but he was a bit of a dick.
Notoriously so.
But it's absolutely brilliant. If you, even if you're not into the Sex Pistols or the punk era, I can't recommend this enough. It's one of the finest musical biopics in documentaries at the moment. It's brilliant.
Now, I've never seen it, admittedly, but when you say that they shot the interviews in the dark, instantly I'm thinking of those news reports, you know, when people have to remain anonymous.
That's exactly it. That is exactly it. And I love the fact that they're kind of, I don't know, they're leaving that element of themselves in the footage that you watch. So it's...
To be fair, no one wants to see what John Lydon looks like these
Christ,
days.
Christ, have you? No, not recently.
Horror show.
Blimey. Whoops.
Disgust me, that guy. I hate the fact he's selling butter on adverts. He's all about, like, oh, I'm against, you know, capitalism. And I'm against, you know, corporate companies. Oh, but buy some butter.
Wasn't against the check, was he?
And you had Iggy Pop selling insurance. Henry Rollins from Black Flag is now advertising like Calvin Klein pants or something. What happened to these supposed punks, these anti-establishment punks?
They got older and they needed to pay the gas bill. That's what happened. But there's the, one of the most defining parts about this documentary is when John Lydon is discussing the death of Sid Vicious. You know, only Sid Vicious will know what happened on that day with him and Nancy Spungen. But it's, you can clearly tell it still affects him. In complete darkness, breaking down over his mate's death. It's powerful stuff.
I'm the same as Ben. I've not seen this, but this is what always happens when one skips the end. I listen to someone, they give their point, and I'm like, okay, I will do that. And I promise you, I'll go and watch this at some point.
Yeah, me too.
Cracking. It's,
me
too. It also intersperses with Richard III, because Lydon actually compares himself to Richard III, like deformed, a complete, like, you know, anarchist, like against the system. And the way how it interjects in throughout the whole film is class.
You saw this well.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to check this out,
I'm actually going to follow up with this because I've got a music choice as well. Okay. So I'm going for Metallica, Some Kind of Monster.
I haven't seen this.
Me neither, ridiculously.
Wow. So basically, I'll give you a bit of a history into them. They lost their bassist in 2001 where Jason quit the band. He wanted to not be part of this big limelight anymore in Metallica. That's a big decision when you're in one of the world's biggest bands. So they go on a hunt to replace him. Now, during this process, they're recording a new album called Saint Anger, which I call Stanger. Now, I will gladly say this on here now. It's the worst album they've ever done, in my opinion. I think it's dreadful. The snare sound on that is the worst thing I've ever heard. But the songs are shite. You can tell they're going through turmoil as a band because they're just on the documentary, you see James Hetfield sitting there writing the lyrics literally on the day of recording. He's got the rest of the band pissing him off all the time. Him and Lars are always at each other's throats all the time. And this documentary, they don't turn the cameras off when they're fighting. They're going at it. You're to the point where you're like, I'm not just siding with James because I have so much respect for him and I don't have any respect for Lars. But Lars is the ultimate dickhead. And this film proves it in every way you could ever imagine. But what's really good is their guitarist, Kirk, is literally never really involved in any discussions or argument. All he'll ever do is watch over, and he's got his guitar, and they're going at each other's throats, the other two, and he'll just go, can I play my solo now? And it's absolutely hilarious that he's the outsider of the band, really, because he just doesn't get involved in the heated discussions or the songwriting. He just stands back, and he's just ready to play his solo, and it's
like a really dark Spinal Tap, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the worst part about it, is because it's not a spoof, you are watching it thinking, cringing at times, thinking this is terrible. But obviously, when I said earlier that the bassist Jason leaves, he does go in and join some sort of college band. He just wants to start from his roots again and not be in the limelight. So he goes to this local gig where he's in his new band. And what happens? Metallica come and make a guest appearance. And you can see his face like, the reason I left this band is because I don't want to be surrounded by you guys.
Yeah.
Now you've come, the press are here, the media here. Everyone now is doing what I try to escape from. But the recording process for any person that's into music, or even if you're not, it's a fascinating watch to see how they gel, how they don't gel, and that they still have lasted so many years. But I'll be honest, on this documentary, they hate each other.
Wow.
But apparently, so they say, they came out stronger the other side of it. Because didn't they then go through therapy on the foot? You see them attending therapy sessions.
Yep.
Like group, like sort of like marriage therapy, but for the band.
It's like Sopranos with Metallica.
And Dr. Phil.
Yeah, it's really intense at times.
Yeah.
But if you're a fan of music, I recommend it. If you're a fan of Metallica, you've got to see it. Ben, put this above bloody Gemma's Choice. Yeah. I'm saying it now.
I've literally been here 5 minutes.
I'm sorry.
You're vetoing my choice.
All right, new girl.
Yeah.
Wind your neck in.
You've got a good choice, but this is something that I know Ben would really appreciate because he's got a love for this band and a lot of their earlier albums. But it doesn't take my love away from Metallica. They've always been one of my favourites, but it does make you realise that they aren't the close, tight unit that you'd expect.
I'm sure that we've said that we're going to get together one night with a few cans and watch this in your cinema room. We just haven't got round to it yet.
We'll do it now. Gemma's joined.
Let's do that, because I really do
want
to see it.
And then we'll do your one.
All right. No one's really fussed about that one now.
No, we're not going to bother.
Well, to continue this pattern, I'm going to go with the music one as well. I've gone with a documentary from 2005 called Metal, A Headbanger's Journey.
Okay.
It's a documentary. Have either of you heard of it?
No.
I've heard of it, but I've not seen it.
It's a documentary that is directed and presented by a chap called Sam Dunn, who is a Canadian anthropologist. As well as that, he's also a metalhead. So he's put together this documentary that traces the roots and the evolution of metal from the sort of mid to late 60s to 2005 when the film was made. But he doesn't just look at it as an evolution of a musical style. He looks at it as an evolution of a social group. So it's all about the fandom. And he looks at it the way an anthropologist looks at life. You know, anthropologists look at how cultures evolve. And he looks at that, but through the filter of metal, the various subgenres within it, and the fan groups that have sprung up in it. So it's a fascinating documentary. It is really aimed at metalheads like myself. I think you'd dig it, Mark, as a metal fan. But I think there's a lot to recommend. Even if you're not into that music, I think it's a fascinating way of looking at the growth of a music genre.
It's like BBC Four used to do documentaries on particular genres of music as well, and traced it back to the very early beginnings to what today's standard is. And that sounds great.
Yeah, and in fact, he then made a TV series based on this, where in the film's a couple of hours long, and he goes through all these various different subgenres that have sprung up. But then in the TV series, each episode kind of narrows its focus to one particular subgenre or one particular era, and it's brilliant. So I've sat and watched the full 7-hour TV or 11-hour TV series, whatever it is, as well. Utterly fascinating to me.
Does he talk to any bands in there? Does he get any bands on board?
It's full of interviews, and he interviews big names like Tony Iommi from Sabbath,
wow,
Bruce Dickinson from Maiden, Lemmy, you know. It's,
sold.
It's an absolutely fantastic documentary, and I must have seen it 6 or 7 times. And then he did a follow-up to it as well. I think it was called World Metal, where he goes and experiences cultures where metal has never really existed before, but it's springing up, like Indian metal bands. You don't think of India as having a thriving metal scene. So he goes and meets the cultures that are springing up there, and it's brilliant stuff. Really,
so what, is it like a couple
fantastic
of hours, this stuff?
Yeah, it's a couple of hours on the first one.
I didn't see this.
Then you can follow up by watching the TV series that he did after it as well. It's absolutely Brilliant.
Gemma, yours has gone down to third choice. I know.
I'm just glad I didn't select, like, you know, This Is Me or the One Direction one. God, I would have been kicked out. Would have been on my ass.
That was my next one. You've written it.
Well, I'm for my second choice, I'm going to move away from music. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go for a bit of a, well, the title is Capturing the Freedmans.
It's in my list as well.
I'm so sorry. Now, this is a fascinating documentary. I think in terms of the subject matter, it is about child sex abuse and allegations as well. We are introduced to a family called the Freedmans, and they're batshit, aren't they? They're bonkers.
They're utterly bizarre people, yeah.
Basically, the history of their family can be traced back to home videos where they're a little bit off the wall, a little bit kooky, a little bit quirky. And that changes one day when the father, Arnold Friedman, and his youngest son, Jesse, are both accused of sexually molesting these young boys in their computer class at home. So it kind of turns into like this crazy media circus. Family members start turning on each other. The boys, there's two other sons, isn't there, turn on their mother. Their mother wants nothing to do with this, but she feels very conflicted. And I suppose the real drama is during both court cases of Arnold and Jesse. I mean, it's almost like they're in their own little bubble. So they continue with the films that they produce themselves and, you know, these funny, crazy family nights they have. But the mother is almost this sort of voice of reason, like, what are you doing? You're about to go to prison, both of you. And the bubble bursts at a particularly, I don't know if you agree with me, Ben, but near the end scene, Jesse is going through his trial. And he's just broken down in court saying his father molested him as a young boy. That's why this has happened. And on the outside of the court steps, they're doing like Monty Python sketches. Yeah. They're like laughing
this
it all
sounds
off.
Absolutely mental.
Yeah. It is mental.
But the part after that, they're back in the courtroom. And you don't really see much on the camera, but one of the victim's fathers goes to attack Jesse saying, you raped my son, you son of a bitch. Mm. And it bursts the bubble completely. And this documentary, this was supposed to be about New York's best clown entertainer.
Yeah, one of the brothers, David Friedman, was known as a children's clown on the circuit. And this film's directed by Andrew Jarecki, who is more famous these days for The Jinx, which is one of the best documentary series of all time.
Still on my list. I need to watch this.
Amazing. The Jinx rules. So that's what Jarecki's known for now. Back then, he was this, you know, he was literally making a short film. It wasn't even a full-length documentary, a short film about this clown, David Friedman. Mm-hmm. As he's filming, following David around, this is when everything about the child abuse allegations break and they get charged with it. Yeah. Then he finds out that because they've filmed everything they've ever done on home video, he's got this cachet of documentary evidence he can then rely on to build up this portrait of this family.
It's nuts.
It's amazing.
So they start off as a documentary about something completely different.
Yep. Jarecki went there literally to film a clown.
He must have been like, oh dear. But also, wow.
But also, cha-ching.
So does the start of the documentary go about the clown and it's out as normal?
It's actually on the DVD or the Blu-ray, they actually use that as a bonus footage. Mm-hmm. The original footage that they were using. But it's just the way how everything just unravels. It's disturbing, but it's also fascinating to think that this family were, you could almost say, they were almost ignorant of the consequences of what was going on around them. At the end, I think Arnold was jailed for quite a long amount of time, but he ended up committing suicide in prison. The youngest son, Jesse's now released.
He was released recently, wasn't it? Not that long ago. Yeah.
Yep. And I think there was something, and I did a bit of research after this documentary. He tried to, get almost like a pardon, but they've turned around and said, no.
Yeah,
they still believe that he did these terrible crimes.
Yeah, because he's now claiming that he only admitted to being a part of what his dad did as a way of preventing a longer sentence. Mm-hmm. He said, if I take a plea deal now and say I did it, I'll get a lesser sentence than if I deny it and then get found guilty. Yeah. So he's still claiming he's innocent. He's still claiming it was only his dad.
So is the footage on the film itself, the actual footage, did they release it for the documentary or is it like reenactment?
No, this is, you do see a bit of court footage as well. Like the disturbing part was what was said earlier about you see him pretty much breaking down, saying about, you know, he suffered at the hands of his father and trying to reduce the sentence. But the very next scene is him, you know, pissing around on the stairs with his brothers and having a joke and a laugh.
Right, this has gone to the top of the pile now. Everything else, you've come back stronger than ever.
Sweet.
This sounds unbelievable.
It's a great
I didn't realise that they were starting to make a completely different documentary.
It was nominated for the Oscar in 2000.
I've heard the name. It's just one of those ones that you put on the list, but that's unbelievable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It nearly didn't make my list, I'll be honest, but I rewatched it again and Well, it's on your list as well. Yeah.
I'm thrilled to hear about it. It's something that I will definitely check out. Mm-hmm. I can't really top that now, but my next choice is still within music, but it's Anvil, The Story of Anvil.
Yeah. I really want to watch this. I've still not watched
it. Me neither. Again, it's one that people have been telling me for years I should watch, and I haven't got around to it.
You are I'm going to say it as if you are definitely going to watch it, not like Tremors. You are going to absolutely love Anvil.
Because people say it is like a real-life Spinal Tap.
This is. Mm-hmm. It really point is. So the band is called Anvil. They've been going... So the two main characters are Lips and Rob, and they've been in a band and hanging out since they were 14. And they are hardworking. You can't knock the guys. They're good metal musicians. They're good songwriters, but they never, ever get anywhere.
Okay.
They book tours with people that are just trying to abuse them. Not like in the way that you just mentioned the Freedmans. This is completely different in the way of abuse. This is in the way that they're led to believe they're bigger than they are. So they go and book tours in like Sweden. They'll get there and there's six people there. And you see these guys on the coach literally filming them the whole time, and they get their own little bus. They're not going to be flying on first class. These are guys are not going to make it. They sell hardly any records. They get there and they turn up and they're led to believe that it's sold out and there's literally five or six people. And you see this guy's face as like, I'm not going to get what I want. It is Spinal Tap. It's completely that. But you are cheering them on the whole way through. You are always on their side. You're not laughing at them. It's funny, but you're really rooting for them to do well. And you are so, they capture you, these guys. You are so basically invested in them, in the fact that all you want to do is see them go to that one gig and just sell out and do well. And I'm not going to spoil it, because the ending is quite a happy ending. It's quite a good, satisfying end to this documentary. And you're sure you can work out it goes quite well for them. Excellent. But the whole way through, you get them meeting producers and they're like, hey, look, it's me, Lips. And they're like, who are you? It's like, we recorded with you 5 years ago. Oh, you're that band. And you just see these guys getting knocked down further and further, but they still keep on going. Any other band would have quit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They would have gone, I'm not doing this anymore. We're an embarrassment. But they don't. Brilliant. And it's Ben. Put it above anything else now. This is the one.
Let me ask you, when you say, you know, they're led to believe they're bigger than they are and they go overseas and there's six people there, who caused this? Was it bad management? Were their management over-inflating?
It's poor management. Yeah. So they also believe that they are, if we go to this venue, I'm sure that when people hear our album the week before, they'll start getting on board and realising we are the next Metallica.
Oh, bless.
But bands do talk highly of them. You know, on the documentary, I can't remember who's on there. I think it might be bands like Megadeth and stuff, but they're talking very highly of Anvil. Like, Anvil are awesome. You know, they're musically fantastic. They just never are in the right place at the right time. And it's happened for 40 years.
Oh. Yeah, I do want to see this. It's interesting to me then that it's not just bad management. There is an element of self-delusion there as well.
That's even
all
worse.
The way through.
What we should do is we should do a double night. We'll do the Metallica Some Kind of Monster and the Anvil documentary. Gemma, you can come along and we'll do it, because that is a proper night.
Can we then watch Capturing the Freedmans? Just to finish off the night strong.
You've had your second choice.
I have had my second choice. Go on, Gemma, finish it off.
Okay, so it was really hard not to put this one in, but I've chosen Senna as my third one. Now, the reason I've chosen Senna, and it was kind of the rule I used choosing these three documentaries, I wanted to choose a documentary that would still be with me, so I could think about it a year down the line or 2 weeks or whatever, and it would still be fresh in my head. And Senna is just that documentary. For those who don't know what it's about, it chronicles the life and unfortunate death of Ayrton Senna, who was many regard as the greatest F1 champion of all time. So he's won the title, the world champion title, three times. Had a very, very classic feud with Alain Prost, his teammate. And the way how... is it Asif Kapadia?
You're mispronouncing names.
That's your gimmick, Mark.
Welcome!
I've got a rival.
Sorry, Asif Kapadia, who directed this, as well as the Amy Winehouse documentary recently. Oh, yeah. The way how he does his documentaries is he tries to cut out talking heads. So it's a continuation or a very flowy kind of documentary. So it's like your experience, similar to the Sex Pistols, but without sort of the references. You're in that time at that moment. Mm. So you're there when Senna starts realizing he wants to become an F1 driver after having a go-kart race, or you're there when he's won his first, second, third championship. It's just so compelling, and I defy anybody who at the end of this film, because unfortunately you do kind of see how he lost his life.
Yeah.
It was San Marino, I believe. you do see on board what happens in the crash, and it's still quite distressing now as it was however long ago it was. It's heartbreaking, and it's very, very difficult to watch that scene, actually, especially following that with the funeral. The way how Kapita did the funeral was he filmed, obviously, him having a hero's welcome back to his hometown in Brazil, but it interjects the scenes with him talking to that particular person that's paying tribute on his coffin. It is a real lump in the throat kind of moment. It's incredibly, incredibly sad. But this documentary also reminds you just how great of a guy. He was a real charitable guy, like a guy with sort of heart and passion. And he wanted to sort of fight for those that couldn't fight.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Let me ask you a question. I've not seen this film.
Okay.
Would I enjoy it, bearing in mind that I couldn't give two shits about motorsport?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, you would. Okay. It's more about the person that was Ayrton Senna rather than the sport itself. It's very dramatic as well, and it doesn't focus on, because you think of F1, you just think of cars going around in a circle, technically.
Yeah.
But no, it really does ramp up the drama, and I think with the way how it's shot, the way how the story is told as well, it's not just for petrol heads. Mm-hmm. It really is.
I'm with you there, Ben. I hate Formula One. Yeah. I think it's one of the wankest, most boring sports out there. I couldn't give it 5 minutes of my time. I don't give a shit who's leading at what point. Mm-hmm. If someone's overtaken and whatever, I don't give a shit. It's shite.
I'm with Mark. And the thing is, watching it on TV is one thing, because at least you can follow the whole race. But people who go and watch it live, so you just see the cars going round past you, and then 2 minutes later, where's the spectator?
And these tickets are hundreds of pounds as well.
Worth every penny. No, it's not.
Forget it.
But it's a good documentary. I did see it on a plane, and I really enjoyed it. And the documentary filmmaker has since obviously done Amy, which is a beautifully made documentary.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
It's good to see that he's kind of not like, I was going to say, one trick pony.
He's not a one-trick pony.
He's not a one-hit wonder.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I look forward to kind of what he does next, because he's got a certain style, and
exactly.
he does get your attention to a subject that you don't really give a shit about. Yeah. I don't really give a shit about Amy Winehouse's music either, but the documentary was fascinating.
Oh, it was beautifully done.
I just wish he'd do something that I cared about. You know, he just keeps releasing documentaries about things I don't give a shit about.
If he does a documentary on like Gremlins, he'd be all over it.
Just called Billy. Well, I'm going to have to take this up a bit, because I think it's gone a bit... Ooh,
yes,
so I want to be a bit more lighthearted and be a bit more fun. So my final one, and this is never... We'd never do it in kind of top three in the best documentary, but it is my favourite. So I'm going to end on The King of Kong.
I knew you were going to pick this.
It is by far my favourite documentary. If anyone hasn't seen it, it's about the video game itself, King Kong. Now, Billy Mitchell in 1999 set the world record for this game, and no one ever believed it would be broken.
Mm-hmm.
In 2003, Steve Wiebe, I think that's how you say his name, lost his job. He invested in a arcade machine and sat in his garage every day playing it, saying, "I'm going to beat this guy." It sounds like it shouldn't work for a documentary, but the way that these two are so against each other, Steve, the nicest guy, he's a family guy, he's got kids, he lives with his wife, and he's just literally doing it for a bit of fun. Mitchell is all out to never ever let anyone take this record off him. He is literally like the bad guy.
Like,
he even looks
heel,
like a bad guy.
He?
He's got his real big dark beard and like scary eyes and mullet.
Yeah.
And he looks like this real kind of evil character. A bit like the guy off Nightmare. Who used to present that?
Oh my God!
You know the guy
yes.
I'm on about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What
yeah.
a show that was!
You're in a room. Where am I? There's a loaf
Where
of bread.
Yeah. Step forward. Step right.
No, what?
But I'll spoil it. He breaks the record, and then there's all this controversy about, well, did he? What? No one was there to witness it, and all this. So they actually make him go to this live studio, and the Guinness Book of Records attend. And Billy says he's not turned up because he doesn't want anything to do with it. He thinks it's all forgery. And then he does turn up, and the crowds are there, and the type of people that are involved. There's referees. Mm-hmm. All these different characters are phenomenal, and you'll get to the point where you're just again rooting for them, but you also like the fact that Mitchell's so passionate and giving so much of his life to this game that you do want to see him beaten, but you also are sympathizing from like, oh, but you've had this record for years and it's the only thing that's ever going to go in your way of life, because you are that person that is so infatuated with this game. You're not gonna have a wife and kids or do anything else.
No,
it's all about King Kong. But the referee in there, the other characters you meet, the people that own the game stores, they all are interviewed. They're all wearing team shirts. They're all going outside his house and trying to hassle him in the night to say, "Can we film you playing games?" And It's beautiful.
The thing I love about it, I've seen this film a couple of times. Thing I love about it is it feels like a mockumentary.
Yes.
Because you see these characters, people like Billy, who just don't seem like they can exist in real life. Amazing. It feels like it's been scripted, but it's totally real. But these characters are so out there and so outsized that you just can't believe they are real flesh and blood humans and not made up by a scriptwriter. It's a fantastic film. And I have heard that, I think it's in the pipeline, that they're going to make a fictionalized version of it, a Hollywood movie of it. What's the point? Because this is it. You've got it already in front of you. You can't improve on this.
No.
This documentary is flawless. Don't bother with a fictional version.
It's not got a big budget. It's used a lot of handycam sort of stuff. The footage of the, you know, him doing his home movies, like today I've got nearly to the end, but you see him playing the game in his garage, Steve, and his daughter's all over him, like jumping over him, like, Dad. And he's like, look, I'm literally about to break the world record here. Go and ask your mom to make you dinner. And it's just so nice to see this kind of, it's not staged.
Yeah,
it's great.
Yeah, sounds
it is
awesome.
Absolutely brilliant. Have you seen it?
No, I know. I know.
Get on it.
We'll have that on. We'll have a documentary night at my house.
Do you know what's fascinating though? When we do these top threes, generally, more often than not, any film or performance or whatever we discuss, most of, not all of them, we will have all seen, generally speaking. But this one, almost everything we've said, at least one hasn't seen it. And I think that sort of speaks to the type of films that documentaries are. Your big Hollywood blockbusters or your classic films, pretty much everyone gravitates towards. But because documentaries are, by their nature, sort of low-key and fly under the radar, so many good things can pass you by and you might never get the chance, until someone tells you how great this is and you have to go out and watch it. They're not in the public consciousness as much as, say, Star Trek. Trek Beyond is.
And you know what's good about the documentaries is there's not really usually like a follow-up, so it's not going to get dated. It's not like, what, you've not seen Star Trek, like you said, you've not seen Star Trek 2, or you need to see this one first.
Yeah.
And they're all on Netflix and Amazon, like documentaries, they're full of them. Exactly. All the ones we've mentioned today, you will find on Netflix or Amazon.
I mean, you mentioned The Jinx as well, but I think probably what's really thrust into the spotlight is probably Making a Murderer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is just phenomenal. And there is actually is going to be a follow-up confirmed.
Apparently so, yeah.
And that's the first time I think I've ever heard of a sequel to a documentary. Yeah.
I'll tell you what, though, if you like Making a Murderer, you will love The Jinx. Oh, it's so much better.
It looks fascinating. Yeah, it really does. So
it's amazing.
It's going to happen.
So it's my final choice then.
The last one, mate.
Yeah, and I'm going to just bring it back down. We're back into Senna territory here. My final one, and similar to you, Mark, I've saved what I consider the best for last. This is my favourite documentary. I've gone with Grizzly Man.
Oh, this is a great film.
Have you both seen it?
No, I absolutely loved it.
Again, Gemma. I know the premise of this.
Yeah. For those that don't know, it's a film that's directed by classic mental case German auteur Werner Herzog. And it's about a chap called Timothy Treadwell, who for 13 years used to go and spend the summer in a national park in Alaska befriending bears. He considered himself an environmentalist and he wanted to protect the bears from poaching. Never mind the fact that no bear had ever been poached in that particular national park. He took it upon himself to go and protect them every summer. The problem was he had no kind of training or anything with regards to dealing with animals, let alone, you know, murderous bears. He was just a slightly nutty man who thought he was saving the world when he was just putting himself in danger. So much so that in the 13th summer, he and his girlfriend who were there both got murdered by bears and eaten.
Christ.
And this is a documentary about the kind of person that Timothy Treadwell was, that what leads someone to believe that they're protecting the bears when all they're doing is putting themselves and their girlfriend in danger.
Blimey.
And I can't talk about this without mentioning a specific thing, and I'm sorry, Gemma, because it's a huge spoiler.
You go for it.
But what he used to do, Treadwell, is he used to film all his encounters. So he used to take like DAT tapes and video cameras and everything. So there's lots of footage of him out with the bears, including the time when he got mauled to death.
Yeah.
Now, Werner Herzog decided not to show the footage or play the audio.
Okay.
But what you see, and it's one of the most famous iconic scenes in documentary, is you see Werner Herzog sat at a table with headphones on, listening to Timothy Treadwell and his girlfriend being, you know, eaten by this bear. And just the look of horror on his face, even though you can't hear it yourself, you start to imagine what Herzog is hearing, and it's like your heart stops.
I think that's more captivating watching him.
Yeah.
I think that hits you harder because of his real expression of pure distraught.
Mm-hmm.
But like we joke about stuff like The Revenant, how that bear looks so realistic, that scene where it's beating him up.
Yeah.
This is the real thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never even seen this, but my face right now is just a pure horror. Like,
it is harrowing.
It's amazing. And the thing is, one of the things I really like about it is that Herzog isn't the kind of documentarian who will just stand by and let things happen. He likes to interject himself and put his opinion. You know, sometimes a documentarian is dispassionate and doesn't get involved. They just present the facts as they are. Herzog likes to put his opinion in. And you can tell that it's not that he didn't respect Treadwell, it's that he thought he was a fool. So Treadwell's whole thing is that he thought that that he was befriending that these bears, and there was nothing wrong with that because he thought that nature was inherently friendly. Mm-hmm. And Herzog basically says, no, nature is inherently cold. And you found that out by getting eaten. It's a terrifying, like, stomach-churning film to watch. And you come out of it thinking that Treadwell was both an idiot, but also potentially mentally ill. Yeah. He was a profoundly damaged man.
God. What I will say, though, is I think that's the way he would have wanted to have died. Out of all the ways, he went out doing what he loved.
Maybe.
And it's not all doom and gloom, this film. You see him with bears when he's in the earlier occasions that he's going, and he gets up to them and he's stroking them and he's with them and he's literally in touching distance of them. And you see his face of, like, he thinks he was put on this planet to be with the bears, and you see how much it means to him.
But the thing is, he would have thought that those 12 years where all that was happening was normal, and the 13th year where he got killed was the aberration. The truth of the matter is, the first 12 years were the aberration. He got really goddamn lucky for 12 years that he didn't get eaten. The 13th year when he got eaten, that is standard bear behaviour, especially because he went later on in the year when it was getting to the point where they're about to hibernate, which means they tend to be more vicious to get food and store food. So, you know, for someone who supposedly knew bears, he should have known, don't go up during killing season.
Hey, it didn't work for Leo either, did it? There was a bit of snow after that attack scene as well. So
it's an absolutely fascinating film. You've got to check it out, Gemma.
I will do. This is great because I'm sort of in my head, I'm going, right, tick, tick, tick. Yeah. Like, watch this, watch
all of
this.
A sight, we'll be watching a new documentary.
It's happening. Mm-hmm. Nothing's on tonight anyway, so.
So, Gemma, what's come through on social media?
Well, I'm glad you asked. through Facebook, we had Darren Wolf, and he picked The Crash Reel, Blackfish, and Mission to Lars.
Oh, Mission to Lars is great.
Isn't that another thing about Lars Ulrich?
It is, yeah. Oh, but also Blackfish is very, very... It's a very bleak...
It's a very upsetting watch.
Yeah, SeaWorld, fuck you.
Agreed.
Craig Foster also gave us his choices. So he got King of Kong, just like you, Mark. Man on Wire, and When We Were Kings, the Muhammad Ali one, which I'm ashamed to say I haven't seen.
That's a great film.
Really want to see that one as well. Philip Hand with Pumping Iron, When We Were Kings, and The Buena Vista Social Club.
I've never seen that.
No, I've heard good things, but because I don't give a damn about that kind of music. I'm not going to watch
it. Something that's knocked around here and there.
What's Pumping Iron?
It's the Arnold Schwarzenegger when he's training as a bodybuilder.
It must have been from the 70s, then.
Sorry, don't know why it all of a sudden came from like Cumbria then. Sorry.
Yeah, it's literally him training. You see how much of a beefcake he becomes.
No steroids used, honest.
None at all.
Nope. And then we had Damien Beggs with It Might Get Loud. This is Spinal Tap.
That doesn't count, I'm afraid. No.
And Team America.
He's missed the point of this entirely, hasn't he?
Damien. but we also got some ideas from Twitter as well. Uh-huh. So we've got Dave at Shiteville Trumite, which is the best username ever. Nostalgia for the Light is simply wonderful. Senna and Encounters at the End of the World.
I've not seen those.
No, I haven't either.
James Ryan at JamesR1107 got The Pervert's Guide to Ideology, Cave of Forgotten Dreams, and The Power of Nightmares. We've also got Extra Going Clear as well.
Going Clear,
yeah. It's the Scientology documentary from Alex Gibney.
That could be good.
It's very good.
And we had Anders Holmes at Fabricus... I'm doing you, Mark.
It's not easy, is it?
It's not easy,
I thought we finally had someone who could read.
Nope.
You can just say Anders Holmes.
Thank you. Anders Holmes. I'm going to try it. At Fabricius91.
Good work.
Check him out. Western Memphis, Grizzly Man, just like you, Ben. And Waltz with Bashir.
Yeah, again, one I've not seen, but I know it's meant to be very good.
A very credited documentary. And
Do you know what I'm very surprised by? That none of us or no one on the social media mentioned The Cove. Have you seen The Cove?
Yes, it made me cry for weeks.
Yeah,
I won't deny it.
Heartbreaking distress. Is it dolphins that are getting slaughtered in Japan?
They
generally lead them into a cove and then beat them to death.
God, no.
If you think Blackfish is upsetting, that's a whole new level.
Oh, I don't know if I could do that.
Brutal.
No.
Go on, Mark, what we got coming up next?
So I'm going for something a bit different here, which I think is going to give us the opportunity again to not have too many crossovers, but there's such a big pool of things to choose.
Okay.
I want from you your top three serial killers in film.
Nice.
This is awesome. Now,
just to confirm out there, I want you to pick the one that you believe is most a serial killer. Mm-hmm. And just for people that get a bit arsy on social media, if they've committed three or more killings...
That's right.
they become a serial killer.
Not someone who really likes shreddies.
No.
can we include mass murderers in that? Because mass murderers and serial killers are defined as different things. A mass murderer is a person who, say, goes into one room and kills a load of people at once. As long as they've killed at least three people in said attack, we can count them, can't we?
That's fine.
Good, good.
I love we've got rules going on. This is awesome. Yes.
So in the next episode, it's top three serial killers. All my friends are heathens, take it slow. Wait for them to ask you who you know. Please don't make any sudden moves. You don't know the half of the abuse. We've been to our local View cinema to see The Suicide Squad, probably the biggest film of the year up to date. Before I start this review, I just want to say now, if you're a new listener or if you've listened before, we will be talking about the storyline. We will be talking about certain moments, so it is going to contain a lot of spoilers. If you are listening and you think, oh, I don't want it ruined for me, go see the film, come back and then listen. But you can fast forward, skip this bit and come back to us and we'll be waiting for you.
Do you know what they should do?
What should they do?
Skip to the end of this particular segment.
I love it.
Wordplay. Yeah.
So normally Ben sums up a movie perfectly, but I'm going to give it a go. So this film is directed by David Ayer. Is that all right to say it like that?
Well, that's
Ayer?
His name. Yes.
Is it David Ayer? I just want to make sure I pronounced it right.
Check his birth certificate.
And it's also written by David Ayer. It's a film about a secret government agency that hire a number of, I kind of want to say superheroes.
Villains.
Non-superheroes.
To basically help out on a mission to combat an evil witch. Is that all right?
Yeah.
So this film has an amazing cast. Features Will Smith, Margot Robbie, we've got Jared Leto, and a number of huge, huge names. Normally, Ben throws it to someone and goes, initial thoughts and this sort of thing, and we say it. I don't want to do it like this. I'm changing it. So I'm going to throw it straight to Ben, and you tell me what you thought of this film. I don't want initial impact thoughts, and then over to Gemma, and she says a little five words. Give it to me.
Well, the way you've just sort of assassinated my way of doing things, I don't know that I really want to give you anything. Oh, I'm
you
not doing it
them.
Ben's way. I'm doing my way.
This is the new Feel Skip to the End. It's got to be different.
Well, I bloody liked it. I nearly said bloody loved it then. I think that would have been an exaggeration. I liked it a whole heck of a lot. And I think the reviews that I've read do it a colossal disservice, as they often do for DC Universe films. The reviewers en masse just seem to want to dislike them and find unnecessary things to pick up on them. I enjoyed the film. I thought it was a great bit of fun. I thought it did exactly what it said on the tin. It was the Suicide Squad going into a suicidal mission. Not all of them survived, so the name was very appropriate. Great bit of fun, two enjoyable hours. Fits nicely into the DC Extended Universe.
Gemma?
I'm going to try and use some different words because I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I think, I before coming into this, I really didn't want to look at any of the reviews that were out. And it got massacred, absolutely massacred. And you know what? It's just proof in the pudding that sometimes critics don't always get it right. It did not feel like 2 hours. It was a heck of a lot of fun. Mm. And you know what as well? Lovely to see Jai Courtney with a bit of a smile on his face.
Do you know what? I'm going to say a phrase that I never thought I would ever say.
Go on.
More Jai Courtney.
Yeah.
I'd have taken more. I really dug him as Boomerang.
Loved him. But yeah, thumbs up all around for me.
Good. Well, I'm on the same page.
Yeah.
I actually said to Ben today, I think I texted you saying, I really hope I enjoy this film because everyone is ripping it to pieces, but I'm going in and I think I'm going to love it. Yeah. And I'm glad that I've not basically done the cool thing of hating. No. Batman versus Superman got a lot of criticism.
Yeah.
When I watch it again, it isn't that great. I find a lot of flaws. Suicide Squad, I much, much preferred to Batman. But I think DC are now on the up.
Yeah.
I think this film was great. I loved all the cast. I was very worried about Will Smith because I thought he might be a bit too Will Smith.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he wasn't.
Yeah.
He was a delight.
He was.
He really was. And I can't believe, Ben, you've just said it, but Jai Courtney is his finest role, and I literally think he was one of the best things in the film.
He was.
Completely.
Which is crazy. Do you know what I think it might be? One of the things, one of my issues with Jai Courtney is that he has no innate charisma whatsoever. He's this blank void of a man. Yeah. But that's because he always plays Americans. Now, he is Australian. So the fact that he got to use his natural accent, I think, frees him up to have a bit of character, a bit of charisma. When you're trying to maintain an accent in your mind, you're then forgetting to act as well. And I think he struggles with that. And a lot of people do when they put on accents. So letting him be an Australian, he was allowed to just let loose and run wild. And I loved him. Yeah. He was great.
Absolutely fantastic. And I like the fact that we got to get a, I mean, I'm not a comic book person. I don't read the DC comics, I'm happy to admit that. However, you know, this film wanted me to invest more in the characters. I wanted to know more about these, like, rogues, really. I wanted more El Diablo, more Captain Boomerang, and Harley Quinn, the star of the show. She's, I friggin' love her.
That's the worry as well, because there was a lot of hype about her. Every single Comic-Con I've been to in the last year has had people cosplaying as her. Mm-hmm. She is going to be everywhere. Her image is all over Twitter at the moment, Facebook. The focus is her more than the rest of the cast. But she delivered, and I was worried that maybe her performance wouldn't match the hype.
Yeah.
She delivered out absolutely every bit she ever could, and I loved her throughout the whole film.
She was absolutely brilliant, completely magnetic, really funny, really charming, and surprisingly emotional. Like, the trailers make her just seem like a bit of a nut, which she, of course, she is. But there are bits in this where the nutty facade cracks, like when she thinks that the Joker's dead, and, you know, you see that genuine emotion. She sat on the car in the rain, virtually in tears, and then the rest of the squad come out, and you see her kind of visibly pull herself together and go back into crazy Harley mode for their benefit, which I thought was a beautiful little twist and performed brilliantly by Margot Robbie.
Yeah, and you know what? I think this is the beginning. This is just the beginning of Margot Robbie. And I know she's been in some very high profile roles, such as The Wolf of Wall Street. Recently she was in Focus as well with Will Smith.
Yep.
But my God, this is, if you didn't know who Margot Robbie was, you're going to know she is. Yeah. She, and arguably the best lines in a film, I think.
Oh yeah, she had some cracking one-liners, certainly.
I'm going to get onto it straight away, and it's something I thought we might talk about later on, but Jared Leto. So I think I've pretty much seen all of his performance in the trailers. He didn't really, I think the screen time may have been 15, 20 minutes for the whole film. Probably not even that. I was going to say, probably I'm being generous there. What did you honestly think of his performance?
Honestly, I really enjoyed it, because it's a different take to what I've seen in previous incarnations of the Joker. You know, he wasn't trying to imitate Jack Nicholson. He wasn't trying to imitate Heath Ledger. It was a brand new spin on what I've seen. He was kind of like a pimp more than anything, like a blinged up pimp. But I really enjoyed it. It's a shame that I didn't see much of him, but I've got a sneaky feeling we might see him in the future.
We'll see a lot more of him. I'll be honest, I didn't love it. He was no Jack Nicholson. He was no Heath Ledger. I tell you what he was, though. He was Jim Carrey in Batman Forever. The first scene he was in, I got a huge Riddler vibe from him. It was pure Jim Carrey. And then I couldn't not see that. That's all I saw every time he came on.
I was kind of in between. At times I really liked him, but he never really fit. I know they made him very crazy and mad in the nightclub. Like, he could snap at any time. Yeah. But, like, Heath Ledger, I was terrified of. I thought that guy was going to pull out a knife and kill you. This was a bit too cartoony, over-the-top, colourful, a bit too jokey. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but not in a threatening way. He didn't seem as scary as, like, Fingy Croc. What's his name?
Killer Croc.
Killer Croc seemed more of a threat to me and more like, oh my God, do not wind this guy up. The Joker just seemed a bit too just silly.
I was expecting him to be a lot more aggressive towards Harley Quinn, because I know about the backstory of their relationship, and believe me, it's not healthy. So I was expecting a lot more hostility or a lot more manipulation. I mean, of course, you know, we do hear the infamous, I'm not gonna kill you, I'm just gonna hurt you real bad. But you don't really see it, and I think that might have taken it added on more charm to Jared Leto's character rather than this menace.
But I
genuinely did like him. I thought it was a really good effort. And I'm a huge fan of his work anyway. He's a great actor.
I need to see more of the Joker. Now, he arrives on the scene again right at the end of this film. So he's obviously going to be in a sequel to this, if there is one. I wonder if he's going to be in the standalone Batman film, though. Because that's what really should happen.
Yeah.
He should survive this and then go on to face Affleck. You know, he's Affleck's Batman's primary villain. So maybe we'll get more of him, more fleshing out of his character.
With this Ben Affleck standalone film, that's probably it. He's probably going to link it all up.
Yeah.
You know, DC will be loving it. All the studios will be loving it. And then they can finally give him his own film. We get him for an hour and a half. Well, 4 hour extended edition. But we'll have that battle that we've been... And then we'll see what he can really do.
Yeah, I hope so. It had the potential during the car chase scene, but there wasn't really any oomph to it.
Yeah.
So it would be nice to see in the future.
What I will say about the DCEU, and how it differs from the MCU. One of the issues that filmmakers within the MCU, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, are having is that there is kind of a homogenized view of what the MCU is. Mm-hmm. Kevin Feige and those guys, they like to keep things a certain way, which is why Edgar Wright left Ant-Man. So most of their product is very samey, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. They're all good. DCEU, even at this early stage, is seeming to be willing to let each film be its own thing. This film, stylistically, was nothing like Batman vs. Superman. It was still a dark film, but it had a hell of a lot more humour. The colour palette was completely different. I mean, there was a hell of a lot of neon in this, you know, rather than the muted greys and browns that Zack Snyder uses. This film, whilst it fits into the universe and Affleck turns up briefly, it felt its own thing.
Absolutely.
Whereas with the possible exception of Guardians, there's no film in the MCU that feels dramatically different from any other film in the MCU because it's homogenized. Mm-hmm. So I like that. I like that Warner Brothers and DC are thinking in that way. Let's bring in filmmakers, let them put their own stamp on it. This is clearly a David Ayer film rather than a DC film. Let filmmakers put their own stamp on it. That's why I'm really looking forward to Wonder Woman.
One thing I really loved about this, you mentioned about how it's a standalone film and it had so much personality. And that actually, I found, came through with the selection of music that was playing through. Mm. It was almost like sort of you had MTV on in the background whilst watching a villain film. Mm. The use of music as well, I put my hat off to it. It was absolutely fantastic. A real diverse kind of mix of music. Like you had Eminem, you had Queen, you had Kanye West in there, you had...
Sabbath.
Of course. You had so much like a real mix of different genres. And I think it added to the actual feel of the film. And it got me excited watching it, having that music in the background.
The energy was there straight away with the music. Yeah. And it was kind of... I don't want to say in a bad way, but it was like a lot of music videos again, with the big, like you said, the big colours and the on-screen sort of neon colours, but also the fonts and everything looked really, really bright. But they made it, the whole cinematography and everything looked beautiful. It wasn't video gamey, which is we've seen before with films like Sucker Punch, which are over the top and doesn't look real. This looked realistic. Mm. They did it well.
Yeah.
Going back to the music, I thought it was overbearing, to be honest. I thought there was too much. I thought it was David Ayer trying to, you know, pump in as many of his favourite songs as he could. Every scene was accompanied by a famous rock track or rap track, and it was a bit grating for me. It was too much. And I know we do it on this show. We try and shoehorn all our favourite songs in, you know.
But that's okay.
Yeah. It's fine when we do it. But that's what it felt like to me.
Yeah.
You know.
Can I raise one of the problems that I had with this film?
Because
it's a great film, but I'm afraid I just did not warm to Cara Delevingne's character, Enchantress.
No.
The whole villain piece didn't really work for me, unfortunately.
Let me ask you a question as a woman. See, we've never been able to do this before. This is going to be your key role here.
Oh.
Is Cara Delevingne an icon to women, to young women especially?
I'm 33. I can give a monkeys. I think for younger sort of late teens, early 20s ladies, I think so. I think, you know, she's a bit of an icon because obviously she's come out and she's got a relationship with St. Vincent as well. And it's quite progressive. It's a lovely thing to see. But it doesn't make up for the fact that she was bland in this film.
The reason why I asked that question is because the young girl, incredibly annoying woman who was sat to my right, when Cara Delevingne first appeared on the screen, she did a little yelp and went, "Yay, Cara," as if, you know, Jesus himself had just appeared on the screen.
Can I swap genders now?
So I was curious then. I didn't know, is Cara this iconic character to these young women? I don't know.
I think the younger, the sort of 18 to 25-year-old girls are like, you know, like they got the obsessions with people like Kim Kardashian, people like that. I think they look up to her for the fact that she's a model and she's... Yeah. You know, she's a very good looking girl, and her body's what they put out there is the ideal thing. And I think she is a bit of a. It's weird because she didn't fall flat on her face. She put in a good performance. Yeah. Her acting was all right.
Yeah. Although the bit when she was possessed, well, towards the end, it looked like she stepped on a live wire with all that machinery going on. Yeah. She was like proper popping a lock in, trying to. And was I right in thinking that she was lip syncing to someone else talking?
That was not Cara Delevingne's voice. That
did
was
not
I don't know whose voice it was, but it was a much sort of deeper, dramatic sort of stage actor's voice.
Oh, absolutely. like Brian Blessed, whilst like Justin Bieber singing or something, I don't know.
Now,
but
that would have been a genuinely frightening villain if Brian Blessed had voiced Enchantress.
If you listen, David Ayer.
For the sequel.
But yeah, she unfortunately, you know, I'm sure she put in an effort, but for me, I don't think it kind of contributed anything. There were just a lot of explosions, a lot of violence, but that was about it.
This is my thing as well. Enchantress, she then decides that she wants to destroy the world or something. It's never clearly defined. And then she creates some sort of machine that then leads to a bolt of light in the sky and then all kinds of trash just flying around. At any point, was it explained what she was doing with the trash? What was that about?
No idea.
Her end game wasn't particularly well defined. A couple of times she said, I'm going to destroy your armies. Then I think she destroyed some Air Force bases or something.
Yeah.
But it wasn't clearly defined what her end game was. What is it? What were the Suicide Squad trying to stop? They didn't. She looked great. She did. The imagery of Enchantress was iconic. She looked brilliant, you know, it would make a great poster. Yeah. But what the F was she doing? What was her plan? I don't know.
No. And it was not explained in any way. No. It wasn't like you went to the toilet and missed out what happened. It was
it's like, oh, she's still angry. Lovely.
I do think the ending when the final battle was happening between them all, I did think that was a bit too much CGI. And I know it had to be, but I was a bit like, Jesus Christ, like you've got away from this film's basically too harsh. The whole of the getting them to enroll in this and believe in it. And then when the battle actually happens with the second hour, it was too full on. And I was literally all the light, and it looked a little bit cheap.
Yeah.
Because it was flashy and too.
It's quite
fake.
Dark as well.
And I know it had to be, but I was just sat there like, this is a bit too much. But I did believe in her as a baddie overall. And you know, the flame kind of creation.
El Diablo. Yes. Oh, I loved him.
I absolutely loved him. And I thought he looked fantastic. Mm-hmm. And the CGI there was flawless. Yeah.
The guy he was fighting, which was Enchantress's brother, did anyone else think he looked a hell of a lot like the Destroyer from Thor? Do you remember in the first Thor film when the Destroyer comes out?
Yes.
It was basically the same thing. He had the sort of the flames underneath sort of metal banding.
Oh, it was. Yeah, hang on. I mean, DC Marvel.
It was a bit too close. I think,
smell a little suit.
Yeah,
but he was very believable, and like you said, when he was fighting at the end, when he was like using that, like kind of like a kind of a whiplash that worked. And I was thinking, God, I wish Whiplash was like that in Iron Man 2, because it looked amazing.
Yeah, it
and the
look
CGI
good.
Was flawless. When like I think at one point he picks up Harley and throws her.
Yeah,
it looked incredible. Yeah. And I was like, this is ace.
I'll tell you what wasn't flawless. Joel Kinnaman's hair. Right. Joel Kinnaman plays Rick Flagg, who's kind of the army leader of the Suicide Squad. You know how they went back and did a lot of reshoots for this?
Yeah.
Clearly, Joel couldn't be arse shaving his head for half of the reshoots, because in most of the film, he's got kind of a flat top, you know, crew cut. And then in other parts of the film, he has hair long enough to slick back.
Yeah.
And, you know, these aren't flashbacks. These are things that are taking place at the same time. His hair just changes in length wildly.
Looked like a bit of a triangular felt at one point as well, just stuck on.
Yeah, it was very bizarre.
I think he did really well as well. I watched him in The Killing.
I love Joel Kinnaman. He's great.
I think he's absolutely fantastic. And I only watched The Killing because of him. I think he's incredible. And when I saw that he was announced in this, I was like, yes, finally people are really taking notice of this guy. And he was in that film pretty much more than any other character.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And that's one of the top build. And I think, fair play to you, nailed that role.
Yeah. Mm. He was the only reason why I watched the RoboCop remake, which was shit, but I like him, and he was fine in it.
I really love him, actually. I'm going to say it now. I want to get him on the podcast.
Yay, let's
get
John
McKean. Come on, Joel. Come on.
He is a really good guy.
Another thing that I thought was a bit off, this is something that I read in a review prior to seeing the film. In this particular review, I forget who it was by, but they mentioned that there's a member of the team who dies quite early, and it was bang obvious they were going to die because they were the only one who didn't get a flashback. And it's true, there's a character called Slipknot whose power apparently is that he can climb things.
Ooh,
that's basically
scared.
What they said. And he is literally the only one of the team who doesn't get a backstory or a flashback. So it was so when he dies, it was kind of like, well, yeah, he was expendable.
Yeah.
Of course he was.
And not only that as well, as soon as he comes out of the car, he hits a woman in the face.
He punches
a woman
in the face.
Oh, we boo him. Boo.
Yeah. It was
He's
terrible.
An ultimate heel.
Because the thing is, if they wanted to dispose of him that quickly, they should have still at least given him a flashback, because then it would have been more of a surprise when he died, because we would have assumed he was integral to the plot.
Absolutely.
But the fact that he was the only one who didn't get one, we knew he was going to get killed. Done.
But I do like the fact that we did get a chance to see each of their, kind of each of their backgrounds. I think obviously we didn't have as much exposure to people like Killer Croc.
No.
However, also another character I absolutely loved was Katana. Is it Katana?
Katana, yeah.
Oh my God, she's incredible. And there was only a very brief scene where you see her talking to her sword, because basically her sword, anyone that she kills with the sword, she collects their souls.
And within the sword.
Within the sword, And her backstory is she's avenging the death of her husband. And there's a bit of an emotional moment before they go down to the subway to confront Enchantress. She's talking to the sword, and she's just completely like overcome with so much emotion. And I really wanted to kind of find out a bit more about her, because she was a badass as well. She was great.
She was very cool.
I think the issue was, because there are so many characters, none of whom we've seen in this universe before, they had to skimp on their backstory. So it was like, here's Katana, her blade maintains the souls of all the people she's killed. Of course she does.
Done.
No more explanation needed. No one even batted an eye. They were just, that makes sense. Yeah, here's Killer Croc. Evolution has effed him over. He's half crocodile. Okay, yep, I'm fine with that. There was no one even raised an eyebrow to be like, what? Say that again?
No.
Everyone just had to accept it because they had to expedite the process of getting to the CGI fights.
To be fair, they did well.
They did
really well. We got backstory from probably 7 or 8 characters in the first 20 minutes. They did very, very well. I mean, fair play. Batman versus Superman did it in the opening credits for Batman. That was a masterpiece.
That was cool.
But I'm glad we're all on the same page. Yeah. It's not. There's not really kind of I hated it. It was terrible.
No. Good bit of fun.
But that was the thing. Like as we were watching it, I was sort of sitting there. I was like, were they watching the same film as we were? Because I was expected to be a bit like Fantastic Four, like first half be all right, second half completely down its arse.
Yeah.
But this was a really fun film. It didn't feel that long at all. It's great.
There are movements in film criticism that critics fall into. Mm. You know, there are certain auteurs that you have to love. People go on about how great Terrence Malick is, even though we all know it's tedious bullshit. They, for some reason, have decided they have to hate DC Extended Universe films, even though they're perfectly serviceable. Even if you didn't love this film, you'd still probably say it was average.
Yes. Yes.
But the reviews, again, are saying it's tripe. You know, they're saying it's, you know, The Room.
Yeah.
It isn't.
Well, hang on.
Sorry, Mark. Sorry.
but I read a thing today saying this made, I can't remember what magazine it was. They said, this makes Fantastic Four, the remake, look a masterpiece. And it's an embarrassment of filmmaking. And I'm like,
nope.
You're just trying to be cool.
Yeah.
Put your fucking put your vape away. Don't bother. Yeah. Put your little hat away. Stop trying to be one of the hipsters.
Yeah.
It's fine to say that this film's great.
Yeah. And it's so much better than Fantastic Four.
Oh,
that was genuinely shit.
But it was fun, you know? Yeah. And I think it proves the point that, you know what, these critics, they're not always right.
Except for us.
Yeah. I reckon at this point we should score it.
Yeah.
Let's do it. All right then.
Go first, Gemma. This is your first full-time episode.
Okay.
Put you on the spot.
I'm going to be fair. Okay. So it was a good film. There was a few things that maybe needed improving. So I'm going to give it a very fair 7.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really fair result. I'm going to score it higher as an 8 because I know that I scored Batman versus Superman around a 6 or 7 and it was a lot better for me. So I'm going to give it an 8.
Fair enough. I'm going with Gemma. It's a solid 7 for me. Thoroughly enjoyable. Great way to spend a Friday evening.
Yeah.
So overall, it's me getting to say it. Skip to the End's rating of Suicide Squad, 7 out of 10. It's competition time. On the last episode, we ran a competition to win the biggest bundle we've ever given away. It featured a Krampus bundle, Sisters, Ride Along 2, Dad's Army, My Fat Greek Wedding 2, The Huntsman, The Boss, Central Intelligence, which you've got a watch, a t-shirt, hoodie. I've seen people tweeting this week that won that as well separately. Hail Caesar on DVD. A lot of prizes.
That's a lot.
But unfortunately, it can only go to one winner. It came through an email. I love the dedication that they emailed us. Mm-hmm. The winner is Hayley Mumford.
Oh, well done, Hayley.
So you are going to be getting a lorry coming to your house delivering about 20 boxes worth of merch. But I want to see pictures. I want you to tweet us a picture with all the stuff.
Yeah, I want to see you wearing very seasonal Krampus gear in July.
We also gave away a Bourne bundle, which had a watch for the new Jason Bourne film.
Cool.
And that's going to Beth Wilson on Facebook.
Nice one, Beth.
That's what I mean. We're here to give.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't stop now. As you just heard our review for Suicide Squad, the good guys at Warner Brothers have given us a Suicide Squad bundle. This is where it gets serious. This competition is going to be huge. You get a tattoo sheet, a Harley Quinn replica bat, some playing cards, an official wig... Of Harley. The official t-shirt, you know, like the baseball sort of style jersey.
Yeah, Daddy's Little Monster.
That's the one.
Sweet.
An embroidered hat, which they wore on set of the movie. A power bank, a beach towel, the official Suicide Squad t-shirt. Do you know what I mean?
Pretty good.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
The question I'm putting out there, because I want a lot of people to enter this, is what's the actress's name that plays Harley Quinn in the Suicide Squad?
God, I've got to think about that now.
Mm-hmm.
Let us know on Facebook. You can email us. I recommend emailing us. Look, it worked for Hayley.
It did.
Or tweet us on @STTEpodcast. But the best thing to do is go on skiptheend.co.uk, and that's the links for all our social media. And in 2 weeks' time, I'm going to announce the winner of, and I'm not just saying this, an incredible bundle.
Here it is. It's time. a brand new feature, Movie Mass Debate. So here's how it's going to work. We have in front of us a pot, one of our world-famous pots, full of dozens of names of actors and actresses. And what we're going to do every week is we're going to pick one of those names out of the hat at random, and then the following week, or the following episode, we're going to come back and all discuss our favourite performance by that actor or actress. So those of you who are mourning the death of Skip Back in Time, the feature's basically the same. But instead of talking about the top three films from a particular year, we're talking about the top three performances from a particular actor or actress. Now, because we wanted to keep this secret going into this episode, we've had to pick the name in advance. Going forward, every episode, we will now pick out the name live on air so that you listeners at home have time to have a think about it and pick your own and send them in on the social media. But for this one, we had to go ahead and do it without you. Sorry.
Ben, I've got a quick question. Mm-hmm. Do you mean best performance or best film? I'm a bit confused.
That, dear boy, is a great question. We're talking about best performance. The best performance that person has given. Because, you know, let's say someone like Tom Cruise. You might think that Tom Cruise's best film is Top Gun, but you might think his best performance is Magnolia. Mm-hmm. So we're talking here about the performance of that particular actor. And the first person, we didn't pick this one out of the hat, we actually chose this ourselves. We wanted to lead off with a big name. The first person we're going to movie mass debate over is Tom Hanks.
Grab a tissue, guys.
Too much.
You have to ruin it.
Crude.
What? No, I was just sure there'd be no strongbow on the table, that's all. Okay.
We've been
so
very
excited.
Mature about this and making sure we word it so it doesn't sound derogatory towards...
Oh, I feel bad now. Yeah. Sorry.
Exactly.
Degrading.
Yeah, so let's masturbate over Tom Hanks. Gemma, you go first.
All right, then. So, I'm going to masturbate to...
Sounds worse coming from a woman.
I know, it's so bad.
Don't mean to be sexist. Sorry.
I should have used the space. So my pick is quite recent.
Yeah.
I've gone for Captain Phillips.
Ooh, very interesting.
Captain Phillips.
I'm the captain now.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, right. So you want to hear my reasons as to why I think this the greatest ever performance. Basically, I believe, because he's been around a few years as old Hanksy, but I think this is possibly his most mature performance to date. He went into this as a very stoic, kind of straightforward everyman character. Mm. But you really go through the entire process of his ordeal. You're there when the ship gets hijacked. You're there when he's trying to be as nice as possible to these terrorists and negotiate with them as well. Essentially, you are Captain Phillips. You're genuinely rooting for him to survive.
Yeah.
And you're there. You're there making the decisions with him. The reason why this has completely done it for me, though, is, and sorry to anyone who hasn't seen this, but sod, it's my choice, and I'm going to say why. It's the very last scene. Mm-hmm. The very last scene, and I believe this is possibly Tom Hanks' greatest ever performance in film history, of his film history, at least. Anyway, it's dozens more, but I digress. He is being asked by a Navy person, can you tell me your name, please? How are you feeling? What day is it today? And he genuinely just ever so slightly starts breaking and breaking and breaking and to the point where he is so traumatized as to what's happened in the event of the film, he breaks down.
Yeah.
It is so harrowing. If nobody is genuinely moved by this performance, then you are indeed a robot made of steel, stone, choose the above. But it breaks you.
Yeah.
It made me feel cold.
I think I stayed probably just after 5-10 minutes after the credits went. I was so affected.
Yeah.
Really, really upsetting to watch. But damn it, that is why this is his best performance.
I've got a different answer to you, but I can't disagree with your logic there. Absolutely, yeah. I'm with you. I think it's a phenomenal performance in a great film.
Oh, wow.
The thing, for me, it's one of those perfect marriages of actor and character.
Yeah.
Because the thing about Phillips, I think the word that comes to mind for me for that character is decency. He is the most decent of men. And there is no more decent person in terms of actors than Tom Hanks. He just has that kind of character. You believe him to be a thoroughly honourable, decent man.
Definitely.
And he displays that all the way through the film. And he does it with such a kind of steely determination and calm that when he does finally break down at the end, it's shattering.
But it makes him more human
as well. Yeah,
absolutely. So it's almost like he may have been on autopilot during the ordeal, but to know that he's human, that makes you love him even more.
Mm-hmm.
Just phenomenal.
Yeah, great choice.
This is already better than Skip Back. Look at the discussions we're having. You know what I mean? All those people are now going, yeah, sod Skip Back. We don't need that anymore. Want to hear my choice?
Yeah.
Go on.
Big.
Of course it was Big.
As if it was ever going to be anything else.
Now, it's not just because it's my favourite film by him. That's why I really had to kind of split it here and go, well, actually, he's probably better in, Forrest Gump, or he might be better in Castaway or something like that. But I actually believe, because of how young he was and because of how innocent, and he hadn't had this big CV of millions of films. You know, I think at this point he'd done The Burbs and a couple of other films, or he was about to. He hadn't done stuff like The Green Mile.
Mm.
And the fact of it was his first real chance to shine by a film directed by Penny Marshall. And I think it's just the way that he portrays a child's mind in an adult's body is unbelievable. It's not the fact of the story I love. You know, he makes a wish, he goes to Zoltar and then becomes this adult.
We've all looked for Zoltar.
But the fact is, as Josh Baskin, I believe he is a child. He has that child's mind.
Yeah.
When he first meets a girl and he gets giggly and the receptionist is, the guy says, oh, be careful of her, she'll have her legs wrapped around you is quicker than anything. He's like, oh, I'll stay away from her then. And it's that sweetness of, like, you are just a child. And when he gets to go to the toy shop for the first time and he's playing with the toys, you see him and you're like, that's how I'd be at any age. You know, that is exactly how a child should be. But it's later on in the film when you see the fear, when you know as a child that you might be an adult body, but you are in a hotel on your own in New York. You hear those gun sounds, you hear the cop cars, and the fear when he's lying in the bed. I'm genuinely there with him thinking that must be awful, because you aren't an adult. You are a 9-year-old child who just wants to be at home playing with your walkie-talkies and your mate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're an adult life right now. You've got to try and fall asleep in that hotel, hearing the banging, hearing everything. And I believe it. I genuinely believe that that guy is a child. That's not an easy performance, especially as one of your first films. And it, of course I was going to pick Big, and you probably thought he's going to pick it just so he can justify using Big. But I can't think of a better performance of such an early age and without having this massive CV at that stage.
And do you know what's fascinating about this? I love the film as well, but I think of it as kind of being a fairly light comedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a heavy film. It's not a deep film. It's a light comedy. Yeah. He was nominated for Best Actor at the Oscars for that.
Really?
That's crazy, isn't it?
Because you think of him being nominated for things like Philadelphia. Yeah, I get that. But he was nominated for Best Actor for Big. That is how great he was in a role. I don't think any other actor would have been anywhere near an Oscar nomination for that kind of film.
No.
But because he is that great, nailed it.
Genuinely didn't know that.
Yeah.
Blimey.
Amazing, isn't
it? It just wouldn't happen anymore. I'm trying to think of a modern film. Like, is it 13 going on 30 or whatever it is?
Yeah.
Imagine her getting an Oscar nod.
Oh, God.
Jennifer Garner for that. You know, it wouldn't happen.
Yeah. No.
No.
Amazing film, amazing performance. I'm looking forward to that. I don't know what Ben's going to pick. This is the thing. With Skip Back, I could always guess. Oh, Mark's going to pick this so-and-so. I have no idea.
It does. It really opens it up a lot more. If you're using an actor who has a long CV, it really opens up the choices. I'm going with the 2002 film, The Road to Perdition.
Oh,
wow.
Masterpiece.
It's a phenomenal film directed by Sam Mendes. Love the film from top to bottom. But it's my favourite Hanks performance for one main reason. It's the first and I think only time he's ever really played a villain. Now, that said, he is still the protagonist of the film. He's still the person we're choosing to support and we want him to succeed. But he is playing a Depression-era Chicago gangster. He's a mob enforcer. You see him shoot several people in the face. He didn't do that in Joe vs. the Volcano.
No, or the Burbs.
Or the Burbs. Exactly what I was about to say.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So I love his performance. And again, goes back to that kind of quiet, stoic intensity of the man.
Yeah.
This film has almost no dialogue. You don't really realise it until after it's ended. You go, hold on, how long was that script? 4 pages? Because it doesn't need to be. He's a man of action. You get everything you need to know from the look of his face and how he goes about his business. You have the fact that he is this steely enforcer and you absolutely believe that he is this feared gangland enforcer. But then you also believe that he is a man who just wants to make sure that his kid doesn't make the same mistakes he made. That father-son relationship is beautifully drawn. Like when he teaches his kid, who's, I think, 14 in the film, or the actor was 14, I think the kid's meant to be 12 or something. And he teaches him to drive a car because he wants him to be the getaway driver, because Hanks has come up with this plan that he's going to hit all the mob banks to steal their money to get their attention. And he has to get his 12-year-old kid to be the getaway driver. Yeah. And that moment where he's teaching him how to use the clutch and stuff, it's great. It's just such a warm performance from what would essentially be a cold character. He's a murderer.
Yeah, gotcha.
But of course, Hanks, being the master that he is, he sells it entirely.
I always forget as well, he's acting alongside Daniel Craig in that film and Sam Mendes, who directed it, which I always forget.
Yeah, I did as well, because I'd forgot that, because I watched it again a couple of weeks ago.
Christ, he's a... Oh, my God. Yeah, sorry, it's just
James Bond,
me. Yeah, it bloody is,
Because I didn't remember that he was in it because I hadn't seen this in a few years. And then I was like, oh, hold on, that's how he got the Bond gig there.
Exactly.
Oh, that's how Mendes got the Bond gig. Yeah.
Exactly that.
Yeah. But the thing is, I would argue not only is this film Tom Hanks' best performance, in my opinion, I would also say it's quite possibly Daniel Craig's and undoubtedly Jude Law's.
Yes.
Jude Law as that little rat-faced villain with the rotting teeth.
He's horrible,
but he's brilliant. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant.
And what's the girl from Hateful Eight?
Jennifer Jason Leigh. She gets killed like 20 minutes in and has two lines. It's a waste of her, really.
I was going to say, I always wanted to see more. I'm like, no, die. No. But that film, and I know we're talking more about the performance here, but that film is a really well-made.
The
cinematography, every scene, it's demo material. It's something you want to look how good this looks. Yeah. It's stunning.
The cinematography is absolutely beautiful. And the cinematographer, and whose name I forget, I'm sorry about that, but he and Mendes, they came up with a motif that whenever death was near, there'd be water present.
I love that so much about films.
Yeah, yeah.
I really do.
Especially when you notice it. And more often than not, I don't notice it. I have to read it on IMDb afterwards.
I'm the same.
So I then was watching this through, because I read the IMDb stuff before I rewatched the film recently. So I'm watching it through that prism and you see all these scenes. And very early on, one of the first times is when they're at a funeral. It's maybe the first or second scene. And you see that the body is on ice as a way of preserving it. And you see just the water dripping. Yeah. And that's the first instance of it. Later on in the film, where Hanks's character kills Paul Newman's character, it's pissing it down rain. They're out on the Chicago streets.
I've never seen rain look gorgeous.
Yeah. Oh, God, it's so beautiful. Because the filters and the lighting that the cinematographer uses, it's an amazing
film. I didn't
know
that until you've just said. So I'm kind of like, I think we should have like a drinking game. Every time we've seen water.
Shots.
Strongbow.
Strongbow
shots.
Yeah, that could work.
But, makes it last longer.
That makes me want to watch it again now.
Yeah. Oh, really?
I love it when they do things like that.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Me too. So there you go. That's round one of movie masturbate.
So what do we need to do now? I think we'll obviously take a photo of this amazing Tupperware thing because this is a big one. This isn't even Wilko's. Oh, it is Wilko's.
It is. Of course it is.
Of course it is. This is more of a sandwich box. But I think because Gemma's obviously, this is her first official full-time episode, you get to pick who we're going to masturbate over on episode 52.
Lovely. Let's make it a good one, eh?
The scary thing is, and I'll take a photo to prove this, there is a lot to choose from.
Yeah, there's dozens.
So good luck. Yeah.
It's a lot of masturbating material in here, isn't there? So I'm going to go for this one.
Degrading.
Sorry.
Which I hate.
Right.
Announce it.
For the next masturbate conversation we're going to have, we're going to be choosing the best performance by Bruce Willis.
Ooh. Nice!
Yes, it is happening. Bruce Willis for next time.
Bruce Willis, social media guys, get on it. Get on Facebook, get on Twitter, Instagram, email, however you want to get us. Let us know your suggestions for Bruce Willis's best performance.
Rewatch time. So on the previous episode, the selection was given as Akira.
Ooh,
I know, right?
Probably the best choice Adam ever made for a rewatch.
Yeah. Mm.
So basically, for those, as a bit of a quick recap as to what it's about, it is the 1988 manga classic. So the story of Akira sets just after World War III in the not too distant future in Neo Tokyo. It's a bit of a hard one to describe, so I'm going to do my absolute best. But the crux of the story is there is a power known as Akira, and it is consuming this young lad called Tetsuo. There's three very creepy kids, which I referred to as creepy Channing Tatum, creepy Britney Spears, and creepy Jimmy Cranky.
He does look like Jimmy Cranky, a little fat one.
I'll give you that.
So basically they're trying to help prevent Tetsuo exploding, taking over Neo Tokyo and potentially the world. And his mate Canada just wants him back as he was. Mm-hmm. So sorry if it's not the absolute...
it's your first go at it.
It is. It's
Ben's
a hard one.
Ben's had 50 episodes to nail it. He does it flawless now. I don't know what I'm on about. I'm like, it's an animated film. There's a bloke on a bike and there's a lot of blood.
You know what? That's probably as much better as what
that
it
was,
is.
That was pretty good.
That was really good. So yeah, so in a nutshell, that is Akira. So so we all watched it. And Ben, what did you think?
I bloody love this film. There's you know, I'm very open about this. I've said it many, many times. It's a great film. Here's something for you, just a weird fact to throw out there. So this film is set in 2019.
It is.
And in Neo Tokyo, they're currently building building a new Olympic stadium for the 2020 Neo Tokyo Olympics.
That's right.
Weird coincidence. The 2020 Olympics are actually in Tokyo.
What are the odds?
How mad is that?
They knew.
They had something going there. Yeah, it's an absolutely fantastic film. We'll get into the story, I'm sure, in more detail. But I want to kick off talking about the quality of the animation. So this was a film that was came out in 1988. So it would have been made around 86, 87.
Yep.
It just doesn't look old. It only looks old in the sense that we're not used to seeing hand-drawn animation as much anymore. We're used to CGI now. Yeah. But in terms of the quality of it, it's fantastic. It's flawless.
Beautiful.
Especially because anime around that time was known as being low-budget, limited animation. You know, they'd do things where characters' faces, their mouths would move the exact same way no matter what words they were saying. Backgrounds would be thinly sketched in. Mm-hmm. But the cityscapes within Neo Tokyo are flawless. Like each individual window seems to have its own things going on. Everything about it is gorgeous. The character avatars, each character is unique and moves beautifully. The whole thing looks great. Even little things like when Kaneda and Tetsuo and stuff are driving around on their motorbikes, the blur and the flare coming off the lights on their bike.
First page notes.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It is.
And to think, nowadays you think, yeah, that's par for the course, but this was 1988 and it still looks amazing to me.
That's exactly what I've got. The dedication and the hours you can actually see in every frame.
Mm.
Yeah. Even the stuff then, Ben, when you were talking, the junk that's lying around, I've put here, the amount of detail in the destroyed and the decayed junk on the floor looks unbelievable. And this wasn't on a computer.
Yeah.
This is hand-drawn, and that's the dedication you get for this film. And it's what? In the 80s?
This is, I've realised as well, probably the nearest cartoon that I could possibly think of that had this sense of an apocalyptic atmosphere is probably Nausicaa. The Studio Ghibli film.
Yeah, great film.
There was nothing at this time where this was the norm, like let alone being in America or the UK as well. This is why manga is as celebrated as it is today.
Yeah.
This is flawless.
It is. This is the thing that caused the anime boom in both the US and the UK. This was the film that broke through. Mm-hmm. Apparently, something I was reading the other day, when the Japanese studio wanted to release this in America, they went to George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, who turned it down because they said, it's unmarketable. You won't find an audience for it. Now, they don't make many wrong decisions. Well, George Lucas does. But Spielberg doesn't make many bad decisions. But they got it wrong that time. And then luckily some smaller company picked it up and distributed it. And it caused this boom. You know, things that came since, like Ghost in the Shell and all the kind of mecha movies like Pat LaBour and stuff, they exist in the Western consciousness because of Akira. It's what broke down that door because it's that damn good.
And that's the thing. I don't put this down as just a movie. This is another level of movie because I don't think people give it I know that it's got respect, but I don't think people give it the credit it deserves because you take it for granted now. You see Spirited Away and you think, yeah, that's pretty good. I've got the collection. I've got this one. I've got that one. I've got Ponyo. But this was 20 years before those were being made.
Mm-hmm.
This was hand-drawn frame for frame. The colour, the soundtrack, the amount of detail that goes into this soundtrack.
Can we talk about the soundtrack?
Please.
Because that is incredible. Like, it's just the fact that it's not... You do get elements of actual music being played, but you also get this sort of vocal kind of rhythmic. So it's like a machine listening to, like this car kind of bike machine hybrid vocal kind of nuts in a lot. But it's gorgeous, though. It is so impressive. And again, like, I think the only thing I can compare it to was a few years ago with when The Wind Rises came out. They used a lot of vocal music as opposed to, obviously there was orchestras there, but I love the fact because it, like what you said about, the sense of the decay in a city, that's reflected in the noise as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the noises I love, like there's a scene where Tetsuo, I think a tank has fired at him and it's exploded all around him, and then he just walks out of the flames and the soundtrack is just like dum, 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 dum.
Yeah.
It's so good.
It's the fact that it's not just about what you're visually seeing.
Mm-hmm.
It's all around you. And that's just mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
I had a phase when this film came out. They released, I think it was like the 20th anniversary edition, so a few years back. And I watched it about 10 times, watching it on my projector. I thought how beautiful it looks because, it's kind of remastered. It looked beautiful and I gave it the time.
Yeah.
I won't lie, it's not a film I regularly put on because it's a bit of a heavy going film.
Yeah.
Within the first
film,
few minutes, you get a kind of a rape scene.
You get
murders that are brutal.
Yep. Yeah.
The one thing I'll kind of acknowledge, which I haven't talked about, is how gory this film is and how the portrayal of blood is so in your face.
Mm. It is.
And what it's really kind of opened my eyes up to in this rewatch, because it's probably been 5 or 6 years since I've seen this film, I didn't realise how violent it was. Maybe I've been ignorant and I just took it for granted. No. From watching it at uni. Watched it again last night and I was like, shit, man, that blood when he slices his throat open is in your face. It's not like you turn the camera away and it's kind of that Kill Bill style animation where you see bits but not all of it. You see everything.
Yeah, like when Tetsuo gets his arm cut off as well. Pissing out the hole,
Yeah, but even the bridge scene as well, after, you know, the tank and the army starts shooting towards his, like, followers all of a sudden. Tetsuo's got some followers. And those bullets just go straight through those people, but they're almost still walking.
Yeah.
It's like the shock hasn't absorbed them yet. And I really love the fact that this was gory, because I'm a bit of a gore-fest person.
Well, that's the thing. With the shooting of the one of the main guys in the first 10 minutes, when they're putting the bullets into him, it reminded me of RoboCop. And RoboCop is a few minutes of a robot doing a few seconds. This was honestly 30 seconds of.
Yep.
And it's on the. That's a good sound. But as he's on the floor getting shot at, he carried on, and his bits of limbs and stuff are flying off, and the blood and everywhere, and he's still shooting him. And I'm like, this is how you do it well. You couldn't do this in a film. RoboCop did it, and it was pretty horrific. But this is how you get away with it in animated style.
And I think for me, possibly the most goriest part. I mean, God, there's so many to choose from. But for me, it was Tetsuo's girlfriend. Is it Kaori? Kari. When I'm sure we'll touch on this in a bit, but when towards the end of the scene where Tetsuo's kind of just becoming this huge, great, big monster and consumed with so much power. This girl, Kaori, gets absorbed within him.
Yeah.
And you just see this, all of a sudden, this speck of red where she's kind of being enclosed.
Yeah.
That, to me, that was like, holy shit.
Yeah, he's crushed her like a grape.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you do try and imagine what that is, that's exactly what it was. But the level of gore is just like...
Here's a question, just moving away from that a second.
Yeah.
Did you watch the original Japanese version, or did you watch the English dub?
Always the Japanese.
Now, I too have only ever previously seen this with the original Japanese, as is my way. Whenever I watch an anime, I always watch the original Japanese in subtitles. I chose not to this time. I chose to go with the English dub for one reason. When I do rewatches, I always like to be making notes at the same time as I'm watching the film, which I couldn't really do if it was in Japanese. I need to be able to hear it whilst I'm looking at my laptop.
It was a challenge.
And I will say, the English dubbed version was nowhere near as bad as I thought. It was fine. It was actually pretty good. I thought it was.
Yeah.
You know, they'd managed to sync the words to the mouth movements pretty well. It wasn't perfect, but it was pretty well done. I was actually quite impressed with the English dub, and usually I can't stand the things.
I might have to give it a go then.
Yeah, it's not that bad. That's especially thing, if you're doing something else at the same time.
A lot of people.
Getting a nice cold Strombo dark fruits.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
I'm not going to comment. But it's not often I use this word, masterpiece, right?
Bullshit.
But this is, and I'm sure you both will agree, I've used it for Mac and Me. It's Mac and Me. Mac and Me is not a masterpiece. This is a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
You have to remind yourself, this is 30 years, coming up to the 30th anniversary, which blows my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen recently, we did a rewatch, Gemma, I'm sure you listened to it, of Spirited Away.
I remember.
That obviously isn't even, it's what, 10 years old now?
How
can there be 20 years between these two films? How?
Yeah.
There's 20 years. One's on a, you know, one's used more of a computer, got this massive studio. These guys did it off their own backs. It's.
Yeah, because it was one guy, wasn't it? Wrote.
One guy wrote and directed it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not one guy wrote.
He's on the beat knackered.
Can I
go home now?
Yeah, he's had a paper round. But no, you're right. It is a masterpiece. And as well, you can clearly see, even today's animation, how much it's been inspired by Akira in some form or another.
Oh, yeah.
Not just with the violence, not just with the way how it's drawn, but certain elements as well. It's just lovely to see that even today, animators can appreciate just how important this film is.
Oh, it's hugely influential. Mm-hmm. I will say this, I've seen this film so many times and I absolutely love it. I'm still not entirely sure what happens at the end.
Why do you think I struggled at the beginning?
Yeah.
God.
It absolutely twists my melon, this. Yeah. You know, so Tetsuo gets to the point where he can't retain his psychic powers within his physical form. So he turns into this giant blob baby thing. And then Akira, the original Akira, returns, creates this psychic explosion that then absorbs Tetsuo.
That's right.
And then they kind of create a big bang and create kind of a pocket universe that then disappears.
Yeah, and Channing Tatum, Britney Spears and Jimmy Cranky go in as well.
Yeah, they're all involved.
They're all there. They're on a party.
But I don't know what the bloody... But it's kind of like, I don't care. No. I don't care don't that it doesn't to, make do perfect sense to me, because I'm just so sucked into the visuals and the whole aesthetic of it that it doesn't matter you know, and I kind of like that it's open to a bit of interpretation. Mm-hmm. I just think it's a great film, even though it confuses the bloody hell out of me.
Why not? Mm-hmm. Why not?
This is that one rewatch when I knew that when we were obviously doing it, I knew that all we'd be doing, it's a bit like when we do talking about Empire Strikes Back. Mm. It's just trying to justify how much you love it. It's not a case of, oh, do you like it or do you not? I'm not like, oh, is Ben gonna like this one? I'm really excited to find out if he likes it. And, oh, yeah. Gemma, what do you think? It's just how much you love it.
Yeah.
What do you think to the rumours, persistent rumours for many years, that there's going to be an American live-action remake?
I did hear this. It's an interesting one because originally they were going to try it, but it went too over budget, and so they abandoned it. Mm-hmm. I say let it be. Just leave it as it is. We do see so many reboots these days, so many remakes as well. Some of them may hit the mark, some of them might not.
Yeah.
But I say for this, because it is such a revered classic, I just say let it be.
I'm against it. I won't lie. I read every week about different casting and people who have started to get involved. I read Spielberg at one point was going to do it. He would not touch this. I know because he's watching announce next week now since this episode goes out that he's doing it. But he wouldn't. Why would you want to get involved in something that's just so well respected and just perfect?
Yeah. And plus as well, he might turn the motorbike into a bicycle. You know, the kids like get wrapped up in a white towel.
Akira is a little alien who looks like a scrotum. What I've heard most recently is the director that's been linked with it is Justin Lin, who did the most recent Star Trek and a couple of the last few Fast and Furious films.
Right, yeah.
If any, I don't think they should do it. I think they should leave it well alone. If they're going to do it, I actually think he would be a pretty inspired choice. We know from the Fast and Furious films that he can do cars, high octane chases and stuff, which he'd need to be able to do for the motorbike scenes in this. I kind of think there's a little bit of cynicism in him being picked because he's an Asian American actor, director. Because in America there was such a backlash to the Ghost in the Shell film being whitewashed.
Yep.
I think they're looking for this and saying, okay, we'll bring in an Asian American director to try and offset that a little bit, even though I think he's like Taiwanese American, not Japanese American. Very, you know, absolutely
very different things, countries.
So I think there's an element of cynicism, but that's not to say he's not a good choice. I absolutely think he is. I think if anyone could handle the material, he could.
I just like the idea of people being influenced to make movies with the inspiration of Akira in mind.
Yeah.
I think just leave it at that.
And many have and many will.
Exactly.
So leave it like that. Don't bother trying. And don't put Scarlett Johansson or anyone else big.
God, no.
Don't do it. Leave it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I love it. I love it so much.
Should we score it?
Yeah, go on.
I'm not going to go and give it a 10. Mm. It's a flawless film. The soundtrack's flawless. But for me personally, I wouldn't. Like I said, I've left it 5 years since watching it. I think a film to get 10 off me would be something I absolutely am besotted with. I respect it. It's a masterpiece. It's 9.
Mm-hmm. Gemma?
It's a 9 for me as well. And it's exactly the same reasons. I think it's been a long time since I've watched it as well. It's probably going to be another long time until I revisit it. But I think a 9 is more than justifiable.
Yeah, I agree. It's a very high 9 for me, just knocking on the door for a 10. I don't think it wouldn't get in my top 5 films of all time.
I probably agree.
Would get into my top 10. It'd probably just sneak into the top 10.
Yeah.
A very high 9. So overall, Akira gets 9 out of 10.
Next rewatch. Now, I believe it's you, isn't it, Ben?
It is me, it is. On the next episode, it's our 2-year anniversary special. And we're going to keep it light and breezy and a bit of fun. So the main review is going to be Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates, which looks like an incredibly silly comedy. We're also,
perfect.
As is our anniversary tradition, we're also going to be reviewing the new Sharknado movie.
Yeah.
So look forward to that.
Is that the, what's the title?
The Fourth Awakens. Genius.
And Rollins is in that. Seth Rollins,
of course,
the wrestler,
he is. Yeah.
That film.
Amazing. That's worth a watch, then. And so I wanted to keep on that level. So I've gone for just a kind of a knock-around fun comedy. Now, you two guys in this room, and anyone who's ever listened to this podcast, knows that I am a card-carrying member of the Will Ferrell fan club. Don't shake your head at me, boy.
wasn't just shaking the head there.
There was a gesture that I won't repeat to the listeners, but it was disgraceful. So we're going to do a Will Ferrell film. It is amazing to me that in 51 episodes, we haven't reviewed or rewatched a single Will Ferrell film, seeing as I am such a big Will Ferrell nerd. We're not going to do the obvious one, though, Mark, so you can relax. We're not doing Anchorman.
Good.
We're going to do the other stone-cold Will Ferrell classic.
We're
going to rewatch Step Brothers.
Yeah!
Suffice to say, Gemma's excited.
I'm pretty happy.
Should be good.
I'm bloody happy with that. I thought you were going to say Old School or...
Oh, Old School would have been good. That would have been good. Frank the Tank.
But I'm all for that.
Good. Next time around then, Step Brothers. Time for our brand new game show, Get Fact. Here's how it's going to work. Each of the three of us, we're all kind of the games master today, and each of the three of us has come armed with a set of statements about various films. So, I will read out the name of my film, and I will list three statements about it. One of them is a fact. The other two are barefaced lies. What the other members have to do is they have to write down which of the three they think is the fact. If you get it right, you get a point. What we're going to do is we're going to let this run over 3 weeks. So there won't be a winner today. We're going to cumulatively put together all of our scores. So at the end of 3 weeks, the person with the most scores is the winner. Are we ready to get fact?
I'm fact ready. Me up.
Okay. So I'm going to start then. My first film, and I'm going to provide you with three statements, is 1984 sci-fi classic The Terminator.
Wow.
Statement number one. Co-star Linda Hamilton hated working with Arnold Schwarzenegger so much, she insisted that they only communicate via handwritten notes. Statement number two. Tyrannical Ugandan president Idi Amin has stated that The Terminator is his favourite film of all time. Statement number three. O.J. Simpson was originally considered to play The Terminator, but producers considered him too nice to play a cold-blooded killer. So jot down your answer. Do you think it's number one, number two, or number three? Mark, what have you got?
Number three.
Mark's gone with number three, O.J. Simpson. Gemma?
Number two.
Number two, you've gone with Idi Amin. The correct answer is number three, O.J. Simpson. O.J. Simpson was actually considered for the Arnie role in Terminator.
Wow, that facted me.
That fact you hard. Imagine that. It would have been a very different film.
I want to see that.
I don't think it would have had the same resonance if it starred Nordberg from the Naked Gun films. Wouldn't have been quite as good, would it? No.
Wow.
That's 1 point to Mark.
Wow, well done.
Shall I better keep a tally of who's got what point, shouldn't I? Yeah. Okay.
So the film I've chosen is Mac and Me.
There's a surprise.
The first... What did you call it? The first statement?
Yeah, statement.
Ooh, statement nice. Is, part of the film's box office was donated to the Ronald McDonald House charity. Mm-hmm. The second statement is that Coca-Cola, McDonald's and Skittles helped finance the movie. This is why there are references to these products throughout the film. And finally, Jonathan Ward, who plays Michael... also voiced the character of Zack in Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest, and also the Back to the Future animated series.
Okay.
So I'm looking from you both, which one of those is true? Gemma.
I think number two is true.
So you think that Coca-Cola, McDonald's and Skittles backed the film?
I do.
Ben.
I've gone with number one.
Ben is correct.
What Hey-o! The F? Wow, I've truly revealed just how facted I am.
I'll tell you what I did there.
Go on then.
Coca-Cola and McDonald's did, but Skittles didn't.
Oh,
shenanigans.
That's major.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Come on, Gem, you can't lose this one. It's your go.
Can I? Surely not. So, my first film that I'm going to do my statements on is The Wrestler.
Nice.
So, statement number one. Before the match scenes, Mickey Rourke would G himself up by listening to Hulk Hogan's theme music, I Am a Real American.
I hope that's true.
Can I edit and put a bit of music in there, that theme tune? Yeah,
more than welcome, more Brilliant. Than welcome. When it comes crashing down and it hurts inside. Statement number two. Nicolas Cage was set to star in the movie, but dropped out as he felt he didn't have time to prepare for the part. Mm-hmm. Statement number three. In order to get to know each other better, Mickey Rourke and Marissa Tomei visited strip clubs and wrestling matches to get their characters to connect better. So, Ben, what you thinking?
I've gone with two.
Mark?
Number three.
Ben is correct. Ben is correct. It was supposed to be Nicolas Cage, but he felt he didn't have enough time to prepare. So
I'd have loved to have seen that as well.
Me too. Me too.
The final scene is him wrestling his wig.
Or his career choices.
Or his career, and he lost.
The tax man.
But then the bees would come in. Oh, not the bees!
Okay, my second set of statements then are on 2008 Marvel movie Iron Man.
Nice.
Cool.
Statement number one. Gwyneth Paltrow only took the role of Pepper Potts because the studio was 15 minutes from her house.
We've all been there.
Statement number two. At the time of filming, Robert Downey Jr. was considered such a liability that Marvel Studios had to pay $3 million to insure him, which at the time was the most ever paid to insure one actor. Statement number three. The film was originally going to have a cameo from Marvel superhero She-Hulk. What have you got, Mark?
Number two.
So you're going for Robert Downey Jr. in the insurance liability.
That's been insured, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Gemma?
Number three.
So you're going for the cameo from She-Hulk?
Yeah.
You're both wrong.
It was,
in fact, the fact that the studio was 15 minutes from Gwyneth Paltrow's home so that she could go back and feed her kids their whatever vegan shit they were eating.
Oh, damn it.
Nil point.
My next film choice is The Room.
Again, surprising.
Kel,
you do
surprise.
Realize if I get them all out now, Ben, in episode one, I will have to start thinking outside the box in episode two. So my first statement, the reason why Denny was acting kind of dazed in some of the scenes was he did actually suffer a concussion and Tommy wouldn't let him leave for treatment.
I've got a feeling all of these could possibly be true.
This is going to be the hard one.
That's what she said.
Degrading. According to Greg Sestero's book, Tommy insisted on having his bare bottom filmed and said, if I show my ass in this movie, it will sell. And the very final statement, filming for this film took over 2 years. In that time, two cinematographers were sacked, two resigned, three actors left, and recasts had to happen on the spot.
This is so hard because all of them could be true.
Yeah. I think Mark might have screwed us here again by changing the word of something.
Exactly.
Of course I did. So Gemma, one of your favourite films ever made.
I know, and I have read the book as well.
Yeah.
What's the one that you believe is true?
I think it might be number two.
Okay, so Tommy's bum being on show will sell the film.
I'm going with two as well.
You're both correct.
Hey! Yes! First off, well, no.
All believable though, isn't it?
This is your first point.
Hugely.
I'm going to have to think really hard on the next episode because I only want to talk about them.
So my next statement is regarding Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet.
Ooh, variety in this is brilliant.
Right? Okay, so statement number one. A hairstylist was kidnapped by gang members and held for a $300 ransom. Statement two. Claire Danes came up with the angel outfit design as she felt the original look was too childish. And statement three. At the Capulet party scene, everyone was genuinely drinking booze to make the party look wild and debaucherous. Due to the chaos, Baz Luhrmann never allowed this in his future work.
I'm going straight out there with number two. I believe that's true.
Number two? Okay, Mark says number two.
I'm going two as well.
Wrong.
Uh-oh.
It's number one.
No way.
Yeah. Genuinely happened. A hairstylist was kidnapped by gang members. This was all filmed in, I think it was Mexico or somewhere in
South America. That's a bit, you're presuming there, just because Mexico is known for kidnapping hairdressers and stylists.
I didn't know it invited a racist.
Whoops.
God, we learned. This is good. Yeah. You learn from this game
show.
That's
right, yeah. So, yeah.
Right, is it round three?
Round.
Third and final round. Okay. My questions, or my statements rather, are on 1988 fantasy film Willow.
With the little fella.
Statement number one. Director Ron Howard once said, Willow is my least appreciated movie, and I always thought Warwick Davis should have been nominated for an Academy Award. Statement number two. Producer George Lucas, the original title for the film that he gave it was Munchkins.
Sorry.
Statement number three. At the time of filming, Val Kilmer's quote was $6 million per film, but he took a pay cut and received scale, which is basically Hollywood minimum wage, because he loved the script so much. What are you going for?
Gemma, you go first.
I think it's number one.
I agree, number one. Mm.
So you're both going with Ron Howard saying it was his least appreciated movie, yeah. And he thought Warwick should have been nominated for an Academy Award.
Totally.
You're out of your minds, both.
What?
The real answer is that the original name was Munchkins.
you can't call a film that.
Well, that's why they didn't.
I love it.
Jesus Christ.
Wow. Whoa.
So my final one is the classic masterpiece Clerks. The first statement, the word fuck is said in this film 61 times, mostly between Dante and Jay. Statement number two. One of Kevin Smith's good friends, Brian Johnson, plays four separate roles in this film. He's the Eggman, the cigarette protester. He's also one of the guys that gets offended by the word jizz mopper. And he's also one of the annoying customers that asks a lot of questions about a resident's cat.
Jizz mopper.
Have you never heard that before? And the very final one is Silent Bob's line was originally meant to be delivered by Jason Mewes, but he had such trouble delivering the line, Kevin decided to say it himself.
Okay.
What are we going with, Gemma?
I think it might be the third one.
You think it's that Kevin took on the line because Jay couldn't do it?
Yeah, I do.
I'm going number two, Jizz Mopper.
Gemma, you are correct.
Oh. Yay!
Don't get too silly. You haven't seen the scores yet.
I know, and it's not really good.
Gemma.
Right, so my last one is American Beauty.
Ooh, I think it's American History X.
Not this time.
That's next week.
Right, so statement number one. The suburban neighbourhood that you see at the beginning of the film objected to the film's theme, so Sam Mendes had to pay each house $1,000 so the shoot could be kept. Statement number two. Kirsten Dunst was lined up to appear as Angela Hayes, but refused as she did not want to kiss Kevin Spacey. Shouldn't have to. And number three, during one take during the fitness scene, Kevin Spacey dropped the barbell on himself, resulting in the shoot being delayed for 2 months. What is your answer?
I'm going for number one about each resident being paid $1,000.
Number one?
Yeah.
Okay, Ben, what'd you go?
I'll go number three.
You're both wrong.
Oh, dear.
She didn't want to kiss the old man.
She didn't want any part of it.
I would have kissed him.
He's not a bad-looking fella.
It's all right. I mean, she says yes to Josh Hartnett, but forget about Kevin Spacey. Poor chap.
That's shocking.
Yeah.
So, now, what's the scores on the doors?
Okay, so at the end of round one, two more rounds to play on the next two episodes. As it stands, Mark, you're trailing behind with 1 point. Got Gemma next on two, and then I'm out in front on three.
Oh.
But plenty, plenty more to come. So stay tuned next week when, once again, we get fact.
Wow, this feels a bit different now. Listener questions with you, Gemma. Full time. It's pretty exciting.
See, the listeners didn't know you were going to be here. I'm thinking next episode and the episodes after that, we're going to start to get some focused at you.
I hope so. I feel like I pulled a Beyonce just by dropping in unannounced. This is my lemonade. Oh, no, wait. No, don't say that.
Pretty sure this is that might have been our first Beyonce reference
there
on the
show.
Go. See what Gemma contributes? See? Beyonce.
Now I'm thinking we need to change the music to dun, 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 dun. Question.
Oh, I see what you've done there.
We're going to start things off with Sharon, which is at Sharon underscore SHH.
Sharon Osborne, I assume.
This is quite interesting because me and Ben have done this for a topic, but this is something they'll probably want to find out from you.
Okay.
But I still think me and Ben might have changed. What is your guys' favourite animated movie of all time?
Oh.
Now, me and Ben have done that in a topic.
It's
but
Spirited
we didn't...
Away.
Yeah, same here. I'm sorry to be really like non-surprising. But
no, that's fine.
It's Spirited Away. It has to be.
It's a fact. It's everybody's.
Yeah.
Should be.
Close to that would be Finding Nemo. I really like that film. But Spirited Away is the best animated film.
Close
for
me would be Monsters, Inc.
For me, Toy Story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Ian Young has put, with Suicide Squad now out, are there any other superhero teams you would like to see on the big screen?
The kids from Stranger Things.
What, you want to see that as a movie?
Yeah. I mean, they're kind of a squad, and they've got like 11 as their little superhero buddy. So yeah, let's say the kids from Stranger Things.
Hype it's getting, they could justify a film right now and hit it while it's hot.
I would love to see it.
It would sell like hot...
Pancakes?
Oh, you listen, I like it. Mine would be Teen Titans. So you've got Robin, you've got Kid Flash, Aqualad, and Wonder Girl. How good would that be?
Big fan of Aqualad, are you, Mark? What was your favourite run on Aqualad? Who was your favourite Aqualad artist? You bullshitter. You've never heard of Aqualad.
I'd like to see that. I'd love to see that. Did that sound convincing?
Really did.
I don't know, Ben, you give a real answer.
I'm going to go with a very obvious one. I'm very much looking forward to the Justice League film, especially because there are rumours that there's going to be a surprise appearance by Green Lantern in it, which would be interesting because I think that's the big missing character from the current DC universe.
Nice. Rich, who came on the podcast at Christmas,
who
will be back for the next Star Wars film.
Excellent.
At Christmas, not long to wait, only 6 months. He has put, are there any characters in films that you think you could remove but the film wouldn't be affected in the slightest.
Absolutely, and it's possibly the worst character ever in existence of film. Titus Telesco, Jack Black in I Still Know What You Did Last Summer.
Wow.
I don't think I've seen that film, but I can believe it.
He was infuriating. He's an absolute knobhead. I really don't like him in it. And if he was removed, it wouldn't have done any difference to the film. Also, Jack Dawson's mate in Titanic. Why was he even there? I mean, seriously. Oh, I got a free ticket. Good for you. Sod off.
That's round.
I'm going to go with Jar Jar Binks. I don't think he needed to be in it. Nah. And he didn't make much difference to the storyline. And humanity in Transformers.
I don't remember who that was.
No, in general, humanity, you don't need
it. Oh, right.
You just don't need the people. Yeah, that's the character.
I like that.
Or Hawkeye in Avengers. He didn't do much.
Which is not his fault, because I like Jeremy Renner. They've just not given him a lot to do. My one are several of the bit players in This Is 40. Have you seen This Is 40, the Judd Apatow film?
Still not.
I quite like it, but it is an interminable 2 hours and 13 minutes long. And there are subplots involving Megan Fox, Jason Segel and Chris O'Dowd that have no reason to exist. You could recut that film and get rid of everything involving those three people. It would have no discernible effect on the film whatsoever. And I think it'd probably bring it down to a tight 1 hour, 45 minutes. So get on it, Judd.
I always want to say it's cheese, but that film should be called This Is 40 Minutes Too Long.
Nice.
Which is like every film he's ever done.
Yeah, I'll see it at the box office.
I love the guy. He just needs to learn how to edit.
He does, yeah.
If you need any help, let me know. Riley has put, can you pick a song that you think deserves to be in a movie? That's a personal one. That's a tough one.
That is good. I am a big fan of DJ Shadow. And there's a song on his debut album, Introducing, called Building Steam with a Grain of Salt. And this song is designed to be in a film. It's sublime. It's absolutely beautiful. It's atmospheric. It would go great in kind of like a thriller or a mystery film, and or failing that, anything by Scroobius Pip, because the guy's a legend.
I shall Spotify that song later, the
Please
DJ
do.
Shadow
it's
one.
Great.
Other
or perhaps
services.
Apple Music. Or Tidal if you're a rich prick.
I'm going to go with... Oh, it's a tough question, this one. I'm going to go with Keep Your Eyes Peeled by Queens of the Stone Age.
Tune.
That film should be for a sex scene or a strip joint. It's kind of filthy, that dirty riff. And I can imagine it in something like From Dusk Till Dawn when they go to the club.
Cool.
That sort of dirty... Women are dirty. No, that sort of... I can imagine it. If I make a film, that when there's a scene like Tommy's having sex in the room, that music's going
to
be playing.
The funny thing is that you've gone with the Queens of the Stone Age song and linked it to a Tarantino film, because the song that I always hear, whenever I hear it, and I think this should absolutely be in a Tarantino film, is Hanging Tree by Queens of the Stone Age. Because it's got, you know, it's this really sort of gritty rock song with Mark Lanegan's whiskey-soaked vocal chords.
Right.
And I hear that and I think, why has Tarantino not used this? I'm going to throw out another one. There's a song that we've actually used on an episode a few episodes ago called Restarter by Torch. And it's like an 8-minute sludge metal song with just this kind of droning riff that doesn't change for the whole 8 minutes.
Yeah.
And whenever I hear it, it reminds me of the scene in Sicario. You know when Benicio del Toro has first gone through to Juarez and he kidnaps the guy in the car and they're kind of stalking the other car, just sort of slowly driving behind him. When I hear that song, I instantly think of that scene. And I think someone should use that song, Restarted by Torch, in a scene where someone is quietly being stalked in a car.
Nice.
Put it in the second one.
Yeah.
I wish we were really skilled, and for the next episode, we could upload onto YouTube the music we've just chose in the scene we just did.
I'd seriously love to do that.
Garrett McGuinness, are there any films that you think they could take out most of the dialogue and we'd still know exactly what is going on?
You've mentioned them already, the Transformers films. There is, as you say, the humans don't need to exist, the words don't need to exist either. Robots come from space, they look like cars, explosions occur. Done.
I'm with Ben. I can't. There's nothing else. Anything by Michael Bay, really, but that one especially, or Turtles. You know,
two words. Paulie Shore. There's a film called Biodome.
I like Biodome.
So do I. And I used to watch it loads as like a teenager. And there has been instances where I've just had the noise off, had music on, and that's just been in the background. And I know exactly what's going on. So You don't really need chatter in that film, do you?
I tell you what, Gemma, fingers crossed for pulling Paulie Shore out for the next movie masturbate.
I would like to masturbate over that. This is quite relevant to this episode. Ben Mullings has asked, what's our favourite mockumentary?
Oh.
Come on, Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
Mine isn't. Mine's Kenny. Really is.
Wow, what a flashback that is. I remember about a year ago, maybe 18
Mate,
months ago,
you right
telling me and Adam about Kenny, and we didn't believe. What, he's like an Australian plumber or some shit.
Yeah, who goes in and fixes toilets at festivals and stuff. Don't laugh too hard because it's going to be a future rewatch.
No, honestly, I hope so because I'm sure at the time we said, yeah, we'll watch it and we never did.
Yep.
Excellent.
Gemma, you hold him to this.
I will do.
Chris Duck, now this is a good question, new listener. Your favourite character or actor that you feel improves any film when they show up, no matter how small the part or how big?
Bill Murray.
Oh, that's a great answer.
Well, except for the Ghostbusters reboot.
He wasn't in that in my head. I just close my eyes and pretend.
Yeah.
This might be because I just watched Road to Perdition recently, but Stanley Tucci classes up every joint.
Oh, he does, doesn't
he? He's the best thing in the Hunger Games film.
Him and his teeth. Yeah. Pearly whites.
I'm going to go with Helen Mirren. I think any type of role. But Anthony Hopkins, I've seen films like, what's that, is it Beowulf or something like that? It's a terrible film, but even his, is it Beowulf or something like that?
Is that one with Ray Winston?
I think really bad CGI.
I'm so glad I've never heard of this.
Yeah. I think it's something like that. And he's in it and anything he does, he's unbelievable. This is quite a personal question.
Oh, we like personal.
I'm intrigued to know what movie posters you each have up in your houses.
Mm-hmm. Ah, nice.
Obviously, it's a thing that most students do, but I think Good Film Bus will still carry a few. Not maybe not 50.
Yeah, I've got a few in my house.
Ben's got an advantage because he can
exactly. It's all over.
I'm sitting right next to him. So I've got the classic Pulp Fiction picture with Uma Thurman lying on the bed. I've got the classic Blade Runner original poster. I've got V for Vendetta with a big picture of V at the front with the cross swords. I have got a original Terminator 2 poster. I've got a Darth Vader art print. And I have a shining, really bizarre, trippy collage thing. Yeah.
It's beautiful, that one. Mm-hmm. I'm not allowed them up in my house apart from my cinema room because I'm married and I'm under the thumb. So in my house, I've got, in the cinema room, I've got an original Mist poster where he's looking out into the mist, Stephen
Lovely.
King. I've got The Thing, but not the obvious one. I've got the one where it's like the mountain, just the silhouette. Mm-hmm. I've got a Leon poster with the glasses and you see the skyscrapers in there. And I've got Red State, which is signed by Kevin Smith, which is a really nice frame. But I am, and I think I said this to you recently, Ben, I am going to invest in an original Westworld poster.
Yeah.
But I haven't found one less than about £200.
Eek.
Yeah, I'm having the same struggle trying to find a good-sized Spirited Away one.
Oh.
Other than buying one direct from Japan, which costs a hell of a lot.
Yeah. Any poster companies out there listening?
Yeah, hook us up.
Yeah.
Hi.
Go on, Gemma, what have you got?
I've got My Neighbour Totoro.
Nice.
I have an alternative movie poster for Terminator 2 Judgment Day. An original poster of Live and Let Die. As well, with beautiful, like the cards kind of decked out, mm-hmm. gorgeous. Django Unchained as well, we've got that. And I've got a mini poster of Jaws as well.
Very beautiful. Cool.
Mm.
Adam Sutcliffe has asked, he's had a Amazon voucher for his birthday, and off us all, he wants one book choice he should go out and spend his money on.
Ooh, okay.
That's a lot of faith in us.
That's a great question.
I'm going to go first.
Go on.
You might pick what I'm going to say.
Oh, no.
I say go and invest your money on Ready Player One. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful book with beautiful movie nods. And I think because the film's coming out, if you read it now, you'll love it. And then hopefully the film will come out in a couple of years.
Cool. Okay, well, I'm going to go for an American comedian called Doug Stanhope. Mm. It's called Digging for Mother. Basically chronicles his sort of relationship with his mother as a kid and... To an adult. It's dark, it's funny, and if you haven't seen any of his stand-up, there is one on Netflix at the moment. Go check it out. Go read his book. It's fantastic.
Excellent. I'm going to give him my favourite book of all time. Go out and buy A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole. Arguably the funniest book I've ever read.
There you go. And Excellent. Let us know how you get on.
Please do.
And the very final question is from John Swain, not John Wayne. Ben, will we ever get a photo of your famous bookshelf? I don't think we should. I kind of like holding it back.
And also, my bookshelf is getting disappointing because I went digital. I did what I always said I would never do, and I bought an iPad, and now I buy books digitally. So I'm not as proud of my bookshelf as I once was. It only has half my books on it now.
I was just going to say, we could get a photo of all three of us in front of it, and it could be a shelfie.
Oh,
you're an idiot.
Oh, dear.
Keep the questions coming. Come on, laugh. It's a good joke. I can always rely on Gemma laughing.
Thank you.
She's humouring, yeah.
This is why I'm here.
So as you just heard, on the next episode, you can fire some questions more aimed at Gemma if you want.
Hello.
But me and Ben are still here to answer them.
Yeah.
And the best way to get in contact is to go on skiptothend.co.uk, go on our Twitter, our Facebook, and we tweet out there and it'll say, you know, let us know your questions and we'll answer them all again in 2 weeks' time.
So that brings us to the end of another episode of the Skip to the End podcast, the first in the new era, the Gemma era. How was it for you, Gemma?
Awesome. Yeah. Let's do it again, shall we?
You're coming back,
yeah,
are you?
Yeah, let's do it again.
Yeah. What we didn't mention is this is week one of your probation.
Have I got a review coming up in 3 months?
In 3 months' time, we'll have an on-air review, probation review, see if we're going to keep you or not. So look forward to
we
that.
We could put a poll out there on Twitter. Do we keep Gemma?
How cruel would
brutal.
That be?
That's brutal. I'll do wonders for my self-esteem as well, yeah. So do it.
Well, I think today's been a wonderful experiment. I think it's been a fantastic show, frankly.
It's a good day.
Yeah, it's a very good day.
We found ourselves a gem.
You're an idiot.
Again, I'm humouring him.
Can we have a moratorium on puns? No more puns.
That's it.
That's my get fact kind of segment out of the way then.
Well, I guess we're going to be saying movie masturbate every week, aren't we? So we can't say no pun. Some puns.
That's all right.
You just want me to just not be myself.
pretty much. If you can just sort that out, that'd be fine. Yeah.
Give me a week to work on it.
So speaking of that, in 2 weeks' time, we're going to be back with episode 52, which will be our 2-year anniversary.
Wow.
2 years since we started this whole shebang.
Don't you wow, like, as if, like,
hey,
oh,
I was there from the very beginning as a listener.
Been
come
in
on.
For 5 minutes. Jumping on the bandwagon.
Wow.
It's all mine.
Unbelievable. As I said earlier, it's going to be a bit of a fun one. Our main review is going to be Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates, which looks incredibly silly. Got some great people in it, though. You know, it's got, like, Aubrey Plaza in and...
Anna Kendrick's
in it. Dude from Workaholics.
Yep.
Old Pretty Boy as well, isn't it, whatever his name is.
Old Pretty Boy?
What is his name?
Zac Efron.
That's him, yeah. I do quite like him, actually. He's good in, like, right. The Neighbours films.
I think one thing I will say is he did like one of our tweets once when we put out about the masterpiece or what was it called when we liked
the disaster
it?
The artist.
Yeah.
I put about him being in it and he liked one of our tweets.
Is that right?
Yeah. Oh, wow. Then we have loads of love for Zac
Efron. Oh, we love him big time, yeah.
Totally.
Oh, Pretty Boy, we love him. So we're going to review that. We're going to review Sharknado 4, The Fourth Awakens, which I'm sure will be a masterpiece featuring Seth Rollins. And what is our topic of conversation, Mark?
Our topic is going to be our top 3 serial killers in film, and there is so many to think about.
Oh, I'm already sitting here, the cogs are turning, I'm already thinking about this.
And social media get involved, because I want to read out loads. I love serial killers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. I
inspire. Fictional. I inspire to be one.
I love them from a purely scientific perspective, you know. Yeah. Gemma, what are or who are we going to be mass debating over next time?
We're going to be cracking one out, Bruce.
Come on, Gemma, that's not a pun, that's just being vulgar.
I'm sorry.
So can you try...
So we will be masturbating to Bruce Willis.
Big time.
Brilliant. I was kind of hoping when we brought Gem on, it would, like, kind of stop me being so vulgar.
Yeah.
And the female perspective would make me kind of just, I've got to be not so vulgar. She's worse
She's
than
worse.
Me.
She is worse.
Filth.
You were supposed to
filth.
Class up the joint, but you just made it worse. We're going to be rewatching Step Brothers, another good fun film, because it's going to be a good fun episode. We've got round 2 of Get Fact. Which will
amazing.
Be tremendously good fun. Mm-hmm. And we'll be giving away prizes, taking our listener questions, all sorts of shenanigans.
Oh, and also, this is quite a good little fact, we're going to be at Bloodstock Festival when this we might be listening to
Indeed.
The episode.
Indeed.
So come and say hello if you see us.
Yeah.
We'll be drunk.
Yeah, drunk as lords, watching Gojira and Mastodon.
Yeah.
Can't wait.
And keep an eye out for Mark and me.
Yes,
new
podcast coming soon. So thank you to Kevin Smith for appearing here on Skip to the End. And look out for the full interview on Mark and Me coming when? Is it next week, the week after?
A couple of weeks. I don't want to commit to a date because I want to polish it quite a lot and make sure it's okay. But it won't be. By the time you hear the next episode, you'll have had it.
Yeah. Big time.
It's quite exciting stuff, really.
Indeed it is. So we shall see you in 2 weeks.